Well, good afternoon, everyone. I think we're going to try to get started in the next couple minutes. So my name is Matt McKenna. I'm the director of the Great Lakes Washington Program at the Northeast and West Institute. Thank you very much for coming today. We have a pretty full program, so I'm going to be very brief, but hopefully we're able to collect all the written materials at the front of the room at the sign-in table. We've got materials from a lot of the organizations that are represented here today, and then I also tried to put together a quick folder with some informational materials on the Great Lakes Task Force, on stakeholders in the Great Lakes region. Feel free to contact me either after today's event or shoot me an email. I forgot my business cards, unfortunately. So my email is mmckenna@nemw.org. But feel free to just quickly grab me if you need any more information. I'm going to kick off with a brief introduction of our first segment today to talk about governance in the Great Lakes. I'm very fortunate to have Dave Ulrich, who's been doing these issues for 30-plus years. I think that's about right.
44.
Okay, I undersold it. Dave is currently serving as an advisor to the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities and Towns Initiative, and is also a commissioner on the Great Lakes Fishery Commission. And additionally, we have Victoria Pebbles from the Great Lakes Commission, who will also be addressing these governance issues and the Great Lakes Basin Compact and a lot of other various issues. The Great Lakes Commission is made up of the 8 Great Lakes states, so I think her perspective on how the governance within the region is coordinated. So I'm going to let Dave take the stage here. We're also going to be playing some musical chairs today, so excuse us for that.
So I'm sure you cannot believe that I've been working for 44 years. I look too young to do that. But, in fact, it is, and if you look closely, you'll see every line and wrinkle and broken bone to reflect it. I am going to try to, in a relatively short period of time, create some order out of what has sometimes been described as quite a Byzantine structure of governance for the Great Lakes between the United States and Canada, provinces and states, First Nations, Indian tribes and the Métis people, and cities and towns as well, all of whom have a real interest in this phenomenal resource. So I will be put in charge of the controls here. I need a little more slack. There we go. And I am assuming if I go down. So that's what it looks like. If you get in a satellite or something, you go up, it's pretty beautiful and one of the real distinguishable things from outer space. Some facts that you need to learn to toss around. One of the largest bodies of surface fresh water in the world. Important to say surface because there's a lot of groundwater all over the place. And actually, the Great Lakes of Africa and the Lake Baikal in Russia have more water than the Great Lakes, Lake Baikal, more than all 5 Great Lakes put together, and Lake Tanganyika in Africa is deeper, longer, and has twice as much water as Lake Superior. But, you know, we're still big and it's still a great resource, formed by the glaciers, roughly 94,000 square miles, over 10,000 miles of shoreline, 35 million people, I think, going up a bit, and third largest economy in the world. So it's an important place. There's the basin catchment for the waters that flow into the Great Lakes. A little adjustment has been done with diversions over the years, but that's basically it. When you compare the watershed with the surface of the Great Lakes themselves, it's actually not that much larger. If you compare it with something like the Mississippi, Ohio, Missouri rivers, the actual basin there is relative to the surface water is much greater. And we weren't the first ones to figure out that this is a pretty neat resource. Indigenous people were here long before we were, and there was a reason they came, because of the water and all of the good things that went with it. The early explorers, primarily because there was a good means of transportation across the water and looking for ways to get to the Far East and across the continent. And then the settlers followed and found, you know, between the water availability, the transportation, the incredibly rich soil, not only for forests but eventually for agriculture, was very attractive. Major cities founded and grew in the 1800s. Chicago, where I'm from at this time, and over the last now 47 years, is the largest on the U.S. side. Toronto is a little bit larger than Chicago right now. Lots happened in the turn of from the 1800s to the 1900s with industrial growth, particularly iron and steel and chemicals and petroleum. And then a expansion of agriculture, both of which created major problems for the Great Lakes, as did the larger cities with the sewage problems and things like that. With the decline in the 60s, a lot of the cities, Milwaukee, Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, Buffalo, experienced some real downturns. But many are coming back now, and there's a real rejuvenation and revitalization, and it's interesting, a lot of it is oriented around the waterfronts themselves. So it's very significant. Now what I want to do is create for you a little understanding of the legal framework, the organizational framework, various critical documents that are important for framing the governance structure. And again, it's big, it's complicated, but it is ultimately understandable, and it's worth figuring out because there are so many different players involved. At some point along the line, you're going to kind of need to know how the different players fit in. I didn't mention, but I should make it, it's very important that we had treaties with the Native American tribes who were here before we were. As in Canada, they had treaties with the First Nations as well. There are legal elements to those treaties that play an important role in the overall governance structure as well. And we have developed a term called rights holders that we use in the Great Lakes Water Quality Board to refer to the indigenous peoples who have rights. They are not just another stakeholder. And on the U.S. side, we I used to work for the federal government, I don't anymore, we as the United States have a trust responsibility to the indigenous peoples and the tribes. And that's an important thing to know and keep in mind. One of the first things that we did, and we share this resource with Canada, a lot of times we forget, and on weather maps it used to be the Great White Abyss, up to the north, but now sometimes they actually draw in cities and provincial lines and things like that. They're actually people and countries and cities up to the north of us up there. And the first major document was the Boundary Waters Treaty of 1909, which was much more oriented towards water quantity as opposed to water quality, but really goes all the way from the Atlantic to the Pacific and up into Alaska as well, to deal with various boundary water disputes that come up. And the whole, the primary premise is to prevent and resolve disputes. That has kind of served as the foundation for the U.S. and Canadian relationship on the Great Lakes for a long time. Great Lakes Fishery Convention of 1955 focused on the sea lamprey problem, which was really devastating the fishery, primarily the lake trout, but the other fish in the Great Lakes, and the Fishery Commission has the lead responsibility working with both federal governments and state and provincial governments for implementing sea lamprey control programs. Great Lakes Basin Compact, Victoria is going to cover that. Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement in 1972 basically grew out of rivers catching on fire and getting to a point of being declared dead or walking across them or whatever. And that even more specifically defined the terms of engagement between the United States and Canada as to how we would jointly and collaboratively work together to protect and restore the Great Lakes, and a tremendous amount of work has been done within that framework. Great Lakes Charter in 1985 really laid the groundwork among the states in the U.S. for what later became the Agreement and Compact, which again is something that Victoria will cover. Got to go in the other direction. Now, these are kind of the multi-state and international arrangements and legal documents. Each one of our countries has a whole series of laws that are very specific that deal with problems that affect the Great Lakes. And each one of these on the U.S. side and the Canadian side has played a major role over the years. And then states and provinces enact implementing laws themselves. So it's kind of a lawyer's dream, because there are so many different laws that come into play with all of these. My original training was as a lawyer. I generally introduce myself as a recovering lawyer at this stage of life. Now, shifting from the laws and the legal framework, I wanted to talk just a little bit about the organizational framework. International Joint Commission was created by the Boundary Waters Treaty in 1909. Three U.S., three Canadian commissioners who basically oversee what happens under the Boundary Waters Treaty, what happens under the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement. They don't have the ability to tell either the U.S. or Canada or order them what to do. They do have some direct control over water flows, but in terms of water quality, they only oversee what the U.S. and Canada have jointly committed to under the Water Quality Agreement, and basically say, you're doing what you said you were going to do, or you're not doing what you said you were going to do, or you're doing some and you're not doing some others. It's basically an oversight entity. The Great Lakes Fishery Commission, as I mentioned before, takes the lead role in overseeing the sea lamprey management program. That's roughly 80 to 90% of the activity, and to the tune of $20 to $25 million a year. Mark will correct me if that's pretty close. But again, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, Fisheries and Oceans in Canada, and the state agencies are heavily involved in that. Great Lakes Commission, which Matt and Victoria represent, a major role in all of the programs related to the Great Lakes. Another group that reports directly to the governors and premiers, Conference of Great Lakes Governors and Premiers, Great Lakes and St. Lawrence, deals with more at the policy level. Maybe Victoria will touch a little bit on the difference between those. One near and dear to my heart, Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative. For a long time, cities were really not involved in the discussions at all. I don't know how many of you know much about Mayor Daley in Chicago, but he's not a kind of guy who will just sit back and say, well, you know, I guess we're not part of this. He said, I want to be part of it, and I'm going to form an organization. And over a period of 14 years when I ran it, we grew from 15 cities to 140 U.S. and Canadian cities, basically advocates for the Great Lakes and bringing the local government perspective to the Great Lakes policymaking and decision-making table. And actually, there's a lot of ability to do things at the local level, and we tried to get things done. Then there are lots of non-government organizations as well that are equally as important. This is a slide that violates all of the rules of slides, but if you want to go to one place and see a large percentage of the different organizations that are involved in protecting, restoring, managing the Great Lakes, there's a one-pager for that. And working for mayors, they always say, you know, don't tell me a lot of stuff. Put it on one page. So this was one of my one-pagers. This is where the cities initiatives across the U.S. and Canadian on the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence. Now, moving a little bit to the formal government structures. On the U.S. side, Environmental Protection Agency, Corps of Engineers, Fish and Wildlife, Coast Guard, many other agencies. I think, and Chris can correct me on this, I think there are 11 that are pretty heavily involved on a continuing basis, 10, 12?
We use 16 if you look at the individual
16,
agencies.
Okay, very good. And then the eight states, I think there are 36, 37 tribes, at least in the six states of the Region 5 area, and then there are a few more in upstate New York as well. And as I mentioned, local governments. Canada has similar levels of activities going on there at the different levels of federal, provincial, First Nations, local government. And then they have a very interesting legal entity called conservation authorities, which are kind of like formal watershed agencies, but they have strict and interestingly enough, zoning power in addition to other authorities. So they have that added element there. Planning documents are a lot of, there's a lot of paper that's been generated over the years, and here are just a few of them. One of the critical ones now is this Restoration Initiative Action Plan. I'm sure Chris will touch on that. A strategy developed back in 2005 that laid the foundation for getting GLRI in 2010. States have plans, domestic action plans developed. Canada has similar ones as well. How does all of this work? Well, not as well as it needs to work. There are just so many people involved. There's actually nobody formally in charge. There isn't a czar of the Great Lakes, although some people called a certain appointee in the last administration as the czar, and he didn't like that at all, and it was used very derogatorily. So there's no one really in charge. It requires phenomenal, phenomenal collaboration. And that's very time-consuming, and there's a lot of inertia built into it, and you've got to overcome that. And one of the critical things, in addition to knowing the different organizations and laws and plans and things like that, I really recommend you find the people within those organizations. There are some people who can make stuff happen, and there are people who are not very good at making stuff happen. Find the people who can make stuff happen, because that's one of the biggest challenge. There'll never be enough money. The Great Lakes Restoration Initiative has been fantastic. It's just scratching the surface. The Regional Collaboration Strategy estimated about 20 to 25 billion that it would take to really almost get even, and we've been getting to 300 million a year, which is way more than we've ever gotten in the past. And the key is to, you know, get as much as you can and then make sure that it is used well. You're going to hear about many of these issues. I think climate change is massive in terms of the implications for the Great Lakes. You'll hear a lot about invasive species, toxic pollutants, nutrients, combined sewer overflows, coastal wetlands. So this is important stuff. It's worth taking some time to learn as much as you can. Don't expect to understand it right away. I still don't understand it, but I kind of keep chipping away at it. And the key is to try to use what is there effectively. A lot of people spend their time griping about, I don't like this, I don't like that, or whatever. Take what you've got and try to make it effective. And the bottom line is I think there's great potential for the Great Lakes and the region as a whole in the future. And thank you very much.
We will have time for some questions, but first I would like to introduce Victoria Pebbles with the Great Lakes Commission. She's the program director, and she's gone.
I'm going to have the maybe unenviable position of following Dave, who is a real expert in Great Lakes governance, and I try to follow in his heels sometimes. I'm going to focus on the state and provincial, the role of the states and the provinces, and primarily on the state side because we are in the halls of Congress here. So Dave talked about some of these federal treaty, the Boundary Waters Treaty conventions. There's also a thing called a compact, and I'm going to focus in a little bit on two compacts that are really important and the institutions that support the implementation of those compacts. So this is a schematic that kind of looks at state and provincial institutions across the Great Lakes region. And I'm going to dig into these, so you'll see this this schematic in several forms over the next few slides. So I work for the Great Lakes Commission, the box on the left-hand side, and there's a corollary organization, which I'll talk about in a little bit as well. And we each have different aspects of Great Lakes policy that we oversee with respect to convening the states and provinces. So when you're thinking about the binational entity, our Canadian partners to the north, these arrows here show which are the binational entities. That's the last, really, I'm going to talk about the binational aspect. But what's important is to look at which ones were established in U.S. federal law. So this is, makes the schematic even more confusing. I am going to talk about two compacts. One is the one that established my organization, the Great Lakes Commission, and another one that was established was passed to establish the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence River Basin Water Resources Council, and a little bit about what is an interstate compact. So I've grayed out the binational bodies in this version of the slide, and then just to make it simple, because I'm going to shorten the names of some of these things so that we can follow along more easily, we're talking about the Basin Compact of 55. So when I say that, that's the one that established the Great Lakes Commission, and then the Water Resources Compact of 2008. And some people may come to your offices and start throwing out this term compact. And so what I want to leave you with today is, what's the difference between those two compacts? So you see underneath the boxes here, there's the compacts, and then who oversees or who is the body of the people that are charged with implementing those compacts. So again, the Great Lakes Commission, and then this council, the Water Resources Council. So down below, I've added now another box to say, what are the purposes of them? So if you look at the purposes and the very first line in each of these compacts, it looks really similar. And I'm not going to read it out loud. You can look at it. But both of them are kind of like, protect the Great Lakes. Okay, why are there two compacts? So a little bit more here. Let's look at what is in those compacts. So if you look at the Basin Compact of 55, you see things like comprehensive development, use, and conservation. I like to say that the Basin Compact of 55 called for sustainable development before that term became popular. Now it's resiliency. It has things like planning for water resources, public works, balancing among different water users, and establishing the fifth one, establishing the Great Lakes Commission as an interstate agency. In 2008, there was the Water Resources Compact, and I've highlighted those provisions, a lot of words here. I violated the slide, but takeaway here, it was really about resolving and preventing controversies around water withdrawals, then diversions, and consumptive uses. So really the water supply side of things. So why these two? Where did they come from? So if you, before I get there, let me just, this is just a quick summary of the Water Resources Compact, because it will come up from time to time. You'll say, well, how does that compact work? So it banned new diversions from the basin. There are limited exceptions. You might have heard of the Waukesha decision and the Foxconn controversy. These are things that are under the purview of the Water Resources Compact. There's a requirement to report on cumulative impacts over time, do water conservation efficiency. So really water supply focused. But can you separate water supply from water quality? I argue that you really can't, and we do have a complicated governance framework, can't change that, so we have to really work together to try to make sure that both of these are working in tandem to protect and restore this great body of water that's 20% of the Earth's fresh surface water. So just by way of context here, under the conference, I shortened the name, the Conference of Governors and Premiers is the entity that oversees the framework for dealing with water withdrawals, diversions, and consumptive uses. Again, this is the supply side of things. On the U.S. side, the compact, the interstate compact piece itself is binding, and there's a corollary system with a regional body and water resources agreement on the Canadian side to help bring the Canadians in. That's non-binding, but it's a very detailed process, and so far it's proven to work. And if you want more information, I can recommend Peter Annan's second edition of Great Lakes Water Wars. You can go through all the details on it. That's about all I'm going to say about this, the Water Resources Compact, but bear in mind that there's a U.S. component and a Canadian component to that. I will just talk about drivers. So what was the driver? Why was the Great Lakes Basin Compact created in 1955? Well, there was a desire after the Welland Canal was built. In the early 1950s, there was a desire to have a bigger canal that ships could come in and enhance trade in the region. And actually, our Canadian friends said, well, if you guys don't move on this, we're going to do it all in Canada, and we'll pay for it ourselves. And that was a little scary for the U.S. There was a negotiated agreement. And even as the St. Lawrence Seaway Agreement was being negotiated, the states got together and said, we need to figure out not just how we're going to deal with this new opening of the seaway and could bring a lot of new economic prosperity, but it could also fuel some competition, some interstate competition or competition between our provinces to the north. We need another mechanism to deal with that. And that was the Basin Compact. Fast forward several decades, there was an ongoing controversies and conflicts over water uses, withdrawals, and diversions. I mentioned that previously, really around transferring water, withdrawing water, and then also the cumulative impact. So that was the genesis for the Water Resources Compact. So again, hopefully you understand there's different genesis, different places in time. There was an existing framework, it just didn't work. So there was the charter that Dave alluded to. I don't want to go into detail, but there was a lack of a really functioning framework for dealing with the water withdrawal issues. So the Water Resources Compact, over about 10 years or so of negotiation, met that gap. So I'm going to spend the rest of the time talking about the Great Lakes Commission and who we are. That's the agency that I work for. We are an intergovernmental agency, and we're a party of the states. And those are established in Articles 1 and 4 of our interstate compact. So by virtue of that, we are a public agency and part of the unique governance structure. We are not a state agency, not an NGO, not a consulting firm, and not an advocacy organization, even though we do sometimes advocate, and you may see us in your offices. So if you were to put together an org chart of how an interstate compact agency, what does it look like? And scholars, legal scholars, will call interstate compacts, when they have congressional consent, subfederal and suprastate. That means that they carry the weight to convene and represent the collection of states. So they kind of hover over the states, but below the federal government and the U.S. Congress. I put some dashed lines in there because we do have a formal partnership with the provinces of Quebec and Ontario. If you want to know more about that, I can tell you after. I don't have time today. So we are made up at the Great Lakes Commission of 3 to 5 commissioners. They're appointed by each state and province. That's set forth in our Basin Compact. We're run by a board of directors, a delegation from each, one person from each state and province. We have an executive director, Darren Nichols, as of last April, and other staff like myself and Matt and about 25 others who are based in Ann Arbor, Michigan. So you will see us around from time to time. Really quickly, so what is it if the Water Resource Compact deals with water withdrawals and diversions, what does this other basin compact do? So again, I want to just highlight some of these terms again. And these are the charges that we were given in 1955. And I think it's fair to say, and our partners would agree, that we haven't really used a lot of those. We do some stuff. Many of you know our work on invasive species, our work on WERDA. But there are other things that we really haven't tested, even after more than 60 years of being in existence. But they exist, and it may come time where we do test and start to apply some of these powers and duties that were conferred upon us in 1955. Article 4 really sets up how we're organized. We can actually hold and acquire property. We can take legal action. Again, we've never had to do that. We've done a lot of issuing reports and recommendations, and I'll talk about some of those later on today. And then finally, Article 6, this is kind of the sleeper here in our compact. We don't talk about a lot, but we do a lot of collecting and reporting on data. That's the first bullet on the left. But we haven't really recommended sort of floodplain or zoning laws. That's really the zoning is the province of local governments. And so there's a lot of things in this document that we haven't really leaned into, but could if the circumstances were needed us. We also have the ability to work and with our states to confer and advise on stabilization of lake levels. And interesting enough, our compact mentioned withdrawals in 1955. So it's a very interesting document. It's been, our new executive director would say it's been kind of asleep or in the garage for the last 50 years, so it'll be interesting to see how we shake off the dust from some of these provisions and exercise them more than what we've done in the past. And with that, I will open up for any questions.
Yeah, if there's any questions for either Dave or Victoria or for any other of the panelists, that would be a great time, or we can also move into the next panel since there's a lot of materials to get through. Oh, sorry.
Question for Dave. Dave, you mentioned, so right now the GLRI has about $300 million in funding, but you said something like
$20 to $25 billion in funding. Yeah, over the period of 2004 and 2005, a group of over 1,300 people got together every other month to come up with the Great Lakes Regional Collaboration Strategy. And it was broken down into eight different areas looking at different problems on the Great Lakes. And one of the big debates we had at that time was, what would it really cost to implement all of the things that were in the strategy? And that is where the $20 to $25 billion figure came from. A big part of that was upgrade of wastewater treatment plants and things like that. So I think there was a recognition from the outset that that amount of money was not in the cards for congressional funding. But a key step between that and the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative and the $300 million a year was a study that was co-sponsored by my organization, the Cities Initiative, National Wildlife Federation, and the Council of Great Lakes Industries that worked with the Brookings Institute and basically said if that $20 billion were invested, there would be roughly a $50 billion return on investment as a result of those things. So I think that helped make the case. And when we got the 475 the first year and then 300 million after that, I think people were pretty happy to even get that. But there's got to be a recognition that there's way more work that needs to be done than even that 300 million is covering. Canada right now is in the process, through a collaborative process, to come up with something similar. It very likely will not even be close to the $300 million a year, but there is a hope that there will be more coming in from the Canadian side. So that's where that figure came from the original strategy.
What would you say the states are kind of piecemealing in the state upgrades to a wastewater treatment plan, for instance? Does that contribute additional funding to the $300 million?
Well, you know, cities, first of all, there is the state revolving fund, a whole separate pot of money that is used to fund wastewater treatment plants, and those are specifically excluded from GLRI. And then in order to ultimately pay for that, you know, all of us who are ratepayers for sewage treatment plants, you know, wind up paying back the loans, the low interest loans that people get as a result of that. So, you know, between those two things, and there's been a lot of private money, particularly under Superfund, that has gone into just one example, the Fox River in Wisconsin is going to wind up being over $1 billion in private money that goes into restoring the Fox River Green Bay area of concern. So when you add it all up, it gets closer. But, you know, we're never going to have enough. The key is to make sure that we make the best possible use of what we get.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Good question.
And if there are no other questions, I'm going to move forward with actually a good segue to the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. We have several organizations here to discuss some of the activities. We have Chris Korleski with the U.S. EPA Region 5 office. He's actually the director of the Great Lakes National Program Office that's housed at Region 5. And he'll kind of give a federal perspective of GLRI and talk about the interagency task force and its current activities that are going on. And we also have Chad Lord, who's the policy director for the Healing Our Waters Coalition. It's a large NGO coalition of regional organizations that are looking to protect water quality in the Great Lakes region. Chad is actually based here in D.C. and is housed within the National Parks Conservation Association. So he's a face I'm sure many of you will see around on Capitol Hill. And then we also have Matt Doss with the Great Lakes Commission. I think Victoria gave a very good briefing of what the Great Lakes Commission does and who they are. And Matt will talk about some of the work that the states are doing for these large area of concerns and cleanups, and also discuss the economic impact study that was recently conducted by the Great Lakes Commission and several other organizations. So I'm going to hand the mic over to Chris right now.
Okay. You do not have a presentation, right?
What's that?
You don't have
something. I do not. In fact, I totally violated the rules about presentations on the screen because I don't have one. We're just going to chat a little bit this afternoon. So first, thanks to the Institute for having me. I very much appreciate it. I'm going to fly for about 15 minutes, and there's a few things that I want to cover that I think that are very important. Before I get started, though, my office, we get inquiries all the time from various congressional offices. Here's my promise. I will not leave today after this meeting is over until all your questions are answered. If you need to buttonhole me out in the hallway, please do so. So if no questions, great, but I make you that promise. I'm going to talk about very quickly about the Great Lakes National Program Office, which I have the honor and the privilege of directing. In a nutshell, we have two huge tasks. One, we oversee the U.S.'s implementation of the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. And two, we oversee the U.S.'s implementation of its portion of the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement with Canada. Thank you. I'll be back. That's a lot. I want to go back to something that, and again, this is a very august panel. I'm not sure you realize that, but you've got incredibly smart and knowledgeable people here, and I think you can tell from some of the comments that have been made. I want to go to something that Dave said very quickly. Dave is absolutely right that it is confusing, the numbers of organizations and trying to keep track. And one point I want to make is sometimes it's very easy for an organization like us, which has now at least the statutory mandate, to potentially get sucked up into issues that we really have no formal brief in. And I talk to my staff all the time about be wary of mission creep. We'll get calls where people are complaining about, we're very concerned about the water withdrawals from Wisconsin. And my answer, thankfully, is not in my department. And I don't just mean it as the usual government shuffle, like go talk to somebody else. That's really not within our department. And none of us, certainly, we don't have the resources, as much as I would like to become an expert and have my staff become experts in all the other areas you're going to hear about, we can't do that. So, again, we focus on implementing the GLRI, and we focus on implementing the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement. Dave also mentioned, and you can tell by all the people up here, none of this would be happening. And when I say this, I'm talking about the successful implementation of the GLRI. I certainly think it's successful. And the work under the Water Quality Agreement, if there wasn't tremendous cooperation and communication between the federal agencies. Dave makes a point. We can either say it's 11 departments, 11 federal departments, or 16 federal agencies. That's why there's confusion over the number. The Corps, NOAA, all the ones you would expect. But we also work extremely closely with the states. We work with local government. We work very closely with the tribes, which is not always easy. That can be a very difficult issue for lots of reasons. But none of this would be happening without this cooperation. And I tell people, the money, which I'm going to talk about in a minute, the money obviously is essential. That's the rocket fuel. You're never going to get the rocket off the ground if you don't have the fuel. On the other hand, if you don't have the personnel, the engineers, the people who understand this, who care about this, who communicate and cooperate about this, you wouldn't get anything done either. And one of the points that's been made by a couple of people is so true. Everyone who cares about the Great Lakes is laser focused on the GLRI. And one of the things that comes with that is accountability and responsibility. Because again, as Dave pointed out, the one thing we do not ever want to do is do anything which brings the program's credibility into jeopardy. We want to make sure that these taxpayer dollars are spent as efficiently and effectively and on the most fundamental projects that we can, because we want to be very proud and we want to be able to defend anything we do. Now, that's a little overview, a little bit of history. Before 2010, the Great Lakes National Program Office, again, that's where I'm housed, was a relatively quiet office in Region 5 of USEPA, funded at about $50 million a year. Part of that money went to Legacy Act projects, it paid for staff, etc. In 2010, the first year of the GLRI, the budget for my office went from $50 million to $475 million. Now think about trying to digest that kind of a budgetary increase. Why did that happen? Because, and again, Dave hit it right on the nose, as a result of the regional collaboration efforts that had taken place 5 or 6 years before, there had been a lot of momentum built up to we need to do something in the Great Lakes. Around that time period, the administration and Congress came together and said, yes, we're going to actually start funding this thing called the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. There was no enabling statute. There was nothing in the Clean Water Act at that time about the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. And my line back then was, we go from year to year not knowing if we're going to be here a year from now, because it was all up to congressional authorization on any given year in the budget. As Dave also mentioned, after that first year of $475 million, roughly since then, it's spent $300 million a year, which we are ecstatic to get, absolutely ecstatic to get that money. What do we do with it? Let me talk about the action plan. Even, again, and I'm going to get to the congressional mandates, but even before we had any congressional mandates whatsoever, and we were sort of building the bike and riding it at the same time, to use the old metaphor, we decided that we needed to develop something called an action plan that would basically serve as a blueprint for what are we going to do with this money. The action plan covers a 5-year period. Believe it or not, in the next, hopefully the next month or two, we will be publicly releasing, for public input, the third action plan of the GLRI, covering the time period from fiscal year 2020 to 2024, yet another 5-year period. That action plan, it's only about 30 pages long. You can find it on our website. If you don't know much about what we do, here's the website, glri.us. Go there, and all shall be revealed. It's a good website. Check out the news. But it will explain everything you need to know about the program, including the action plans, what we're doing in AOCs, which Matt's going to talk about later, et cetera. But you need to look at that. The action plan starts out at a very high level. What are our objectives? What are we trying to do? What are our commitments? And then it gets down to what are our measures? What are we going to measure? How are we going to measure progress? Which is one of the reasons I think it's been successful, because not every objective boils down to a specific numeric metric, but many of them do, like the number of beneficial use impairments that are going to be removed, like the number of acres of coastal wetland habitat that are going to be restored. So again, it's very clear what we're trying to do. Again, the upcoming action plan, we hope to make that available for public comment. I'm hoping in about a month, because we want to have that live and on the books by October 1st of next year when the new fiscal year starts. How do we operate? A lot of people say, well, who in the world determines how the money gets spent? How does this work? The way that we are structured, and we've been structured this way from the beginning, but again, I'm going to get to the congressional mandate. The idea, originally there was this thing called, there's going to be the Great Lakes Interagency Task Force, made up of all those, again, 11 departments or 16 agencies of the federal government that would oversee the implementation of the GLRI. USEPA is the chair of that task force. At the more get your hands dirty and really get into the details, you have something called the regional work group, which is what I would say is largely mid-level managers, not agency directors, not agency heads, but people like me or my boss, Kathy Stepp, who by dint of being the Region 5 Administrator is also the National Program Manager, it's their job to actually sit down and make recommendations about what we want to do and then run those by the interagency task force to get buy-in. At the end of the day, most of the direction and the determinations about how the GLRI will operate and what projects will be funded comes through this collaboration of these 16 federal agencies on the basis of a lot of input from, again, states, tribes, local communities, and other people. It's changed somewhat over time. I was actually out of this position for about a year and a half. And where it used to be there was a very formal, this was in the Camp Davis days, there was a very formal interagency task force that the RWG would directly report to. Over time, what's happened is the RWG has sort of transformed itself into the task force. And what's happening is within each agency, as decisions are made by the RWG, the respective members run them up their own flagpoles, get the buy-in from their senior management, and then we go forward. It's a little more efficient, it's a little more informal, but it works very well. So again, this thing called the RWG is sort of the nerve center of the GLRI. Okay, who decides how this $300 million a year gets budgeted? The RWG. And again, through the interagency task force. Those discussions are not easy, but I can tell you that when we started back in 2010, 2011, there was more of a, I don't know a diplomatic way to say this, we were all sort of thinking, what's in it for me kind of approach, and I'm going to get the most I can for my agency's goals. Over time, I think that shifted. And I think the RWG, all the federal agencies said, there's a better way to do this. And that better way is to say, not what money do I need for my agency to accomplish its goals or what we think are the really great projects. What's the best for the Great Lakes? What are the best priorities for the Great Lakes in general? And since then, it's gotten a lot better and a lot easier. And I think we've become much more effective at funding. If you get down into how do you fund individual projects, ultimately they're vetted by the RWG after much technical discussion among the technical experts among all the details, but it is a very detailed and time-consuming process. One thing I should point out, a lot of people don't know, of the $300 million, EPA keeps about 40% of that. The rest of that money we pass through to the other federal agencies to fund their own projects. So while we are the chair of this organization and, again, sort of oversee the implementation, we are sort of first among equals, if you will. It's not just – it's not an EPA program. It is a multi-agency program. I want to talk real briefly just about a couple of other things that I know people are interested in. GLAB, the Great Lakes Advisory Board, because we're getting a lot of questions about that right now. So there was a Great Lakes Advisory Board. It operated for a number of years. I know Dave was a member. Right, Dave, you remember.
He was the chair.
Yeah, you were the chair of the GLAB. That's right. How quickly we forget.
I know.
And for a number of reasons, the GLAB expired. Its charter expired. I want to make sure everybody here knows the GLAB has been reestablished. And, in fact, we had a solicitation of nominations for membership. That nomination period ended this past Monday, the 25th at close of business. We're now in the process of looking at all the applicants. We have quite a number, and over the next few months, we will be selecting the new GLAB. We expect about 15 representatives to serve on the GLAB. The purpose of the GLAB, like any FACA, is to provide us with advice on how to implement the GLRI and how to implement the water quality agreement. The last thing I want to say, because I want to keep us on time and make sure other people have plenty of time to talk. When I started doing this in 2011, it was safe to say that if you talk to people in Congress, senators, representatives, about their views of the GLRI, it was very mixed, even within the Great Lakes. And there were a lot of questions being asked about the efficacy of the program. They were concerned about, is this really going to do much good? How do we know the money is being spent properly? Legitimate issues, good issues that I think any steward of taxpayer money would ask about. I think what's changed, and I think this is a hallmark of the success of the GLRI, At least within the Great Lakes contingent, as near as we can tell, now it appears that there is certainly not unanimous, but there is extremely substantial buy-in of support for the program. There's a couple reasons for that, but the basic reason is that I think people have seen that it works, that it's doing tremendous work. Again, the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, what are we trying to do? We are trying to restore the Great Lakes, and that involves focus areas like invasive species and areas of concern and nutrients and habitat, all the things you're familiar with. But I think people have seen the results. I want to point that out in two ways. First, we have been, the GAO has been in our business very heavily early on. They've done three engagements with the program, and they provided very good reports. They actually did one report where they had no recommendations whatsoever. That's unheard of, and I'm very proud of that. And they definitely came in, and they were in our business. So that was a good sign that, okay, the stewardship is there. But more importantly, at a local level, when people saw what, for example, cleaning up an AOC could do, if you clean up an AOC, you've taken an area which was, had been heavily contaminated for years. What does that mean? You can't eat the fish. You can't swim. Nobody wants to go there. Maybe it smells. Maybe it's an old industrial area where there's nothing there. There's nothing to do. There's no industry. There's no economic energy there. And it's a poor environment. You clean up an AOC, and it's not inexpensive, but you clean up an AOC, and what happens? Certainly, you have restored the environmental value of that area. But I think what people didn't expect to see were the economic benefits that followed from that. An example I always use is, okay, before you didn't want to go there. Why? It was stinky. It was dirty. You didn't want to bring your kids there. Now you can go there. You can fish. It's pretty. Bring your family. Have a picnic. Well, people realize that that's happening. You know what? I'm going to open up a bait shop. Hey, you know what? They're getting people to fish. You know what? I'm going to open up a coffee shop. I'm going to make a brewery. And what happens? My line is, if you clean it, they will come. So I think from an economic development engine standpoint, what people did not expect, and I know Matt's going to talk about this in more detail, are the economic benefits that something like the GLRI is bringing. And I think that turned a lot of people's heads, which we're very, very proud of. I'm going to close with this. I mentioned this earlier. As I said, when we got started, we were making this up as we went along. We had great guidance from the regional collaboration, but again, there's no statute. Congress had not provided any particular direction other than we want this to happen, and we had an executive order dated back to 2004. That changed in 2015 and 2016 when Congress incorporated the concept of the GLRI in the Clean Water Act, Section 118C7, for those of you who want to look at it. So we're there, and it very clearly tells us this is what we want you to do. These are the areas we want you to focus on. And to bring this talk back to where I started, for me, it's critical that we pay very close attention to what is Congress telling us what to do, what are we to focus on, what do we want to be successful at, because again, in this incredibly complicated and complex world of Great Lakes management, it's really easy to lose sight of your vision, and we don't want to do that. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
We will have time for questions, but also I would like to introduce Chad Lord. He's the policy director with the Howe Coalition.
Hey, everybody. Good afternoon. As Matt said, my name is Chad Lord. I am the policy director for the Healing Our Waters Great Lakes Coalition. I'm very pleased to be here today to talk about the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. I hope you all have heard from our members about the GLRI and have heard from our members about the results that the GLRI is producing in your states and in your districts. We have spent an enormous amount of time as a group of 150 non-governmental organizations who came together in 2004 to try and talk about both the need for why we have to restore and protect the Great Lakes, but also the results that we're seeing because of the investments that have been made. And I did put out on the table, and I hope you picked it up, a copy of our latest success story report where we document projects throughout the region that are being undertaken or completed because of the investments from the GLRI. And that is one of a number of reports that go back 10 years that you can access at healthylakes.org if you're interested in looking back and seeing more examples of what we're seeing. So I also do not have a slide presentation, but I did want to just cover a couple of key things that of why we are so excited about the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. Not only is the money important, as already noted, it is that fuel that really catalyzes a lot of work on the ground. But in our opinion, too, it's also the structure of the program itself, which Chris got into. So what is that money and where is it coming from? Well, it goes to EPA. So just because we're talking to you all, that's in the entire EPA bill. So it has gotten $300 million since fiscal year 2011, minus a little bit of a haircut when we had sequestration, I think that was 2012 or 2013. But otherwise, it's holding steady at $300 million. The current administration is not the first administration to propose budget cuts to the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, although this administration is the only one so far that has proposed to eliminate the program. But, you know, even the Obama administration proposed to cut back, and it was only because of the strong support on a bipartisan basis here in Congress were those funds restored. What are those funds going towards? Well, we're going to hear a little bit about the cleanup of the areas of concern, which is a tremendous success story from as a result of the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. But it's also funding projects that are controlling invasive species, doing remediation work, pulling out phragmites and other things. It's going towards helping farmers control runoff from their fields that go, you know, that pollution that gets into our waterways, which we'll hear about on another panel. It's going towards helping communities restore wetlands and other wildlife, which are really important for the outdoor recreation economy and the outdoor way of life that many of your constituents participate in back in all of the Great Lakes states. So that money is very, very important. But as I noted, the structure is also equally as important. And so while EPA is the recipient of all of those funds, because of the work that was done in 2004 as an outgrowth of that executive order, Executive Order 13340, which the President George W. Bush issued, that Great Lakes Regional Collaboration Strategy really does provide a framework for the work that continues to provide a framework for the work that we're doing in the region. It continues to provide guidance in terms of where those priorities should be, and that work continues to play out as we see, I would argue, in the action plans that have been produced, Action Plan 1 and Action Plan 2, and now Action Plan 3 when it comes out for public comment. So it is continuing to provide us with that oversight. And as I already noted, half of the collaboration strategy said we needed $13 billion for sewage overflows and other water infrastructure, and the other half of the funds is designed to go towards wetland remediation, sustainability issues, invasive species, and areas of concern. So that structure in terms of the way the money goes to EPA and then is funneled out to the agencies is really important, because what that has done is it has not created a new program per se. What it has done is created a new structure in which the federal funds can flow from EPA through interagency agreements to the other agencies, and the other agencies can leverage their expertise to help my groups and the other NGOs, cities, states, and others access those funds through grants, cooperative agreements, memorandums of understanding, or whatever the case may be, so they can use the programs that exist under their jurisdiction to push the GLRI money onto the ground and to do the work. And I have here, I'll hand out a whole table of other programs that you should all be familiar with. Because these are the programs in which the GLRI funds projects in the region. It's not just the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, and if we do not, and we would argue that if you are not paying attention to the other agencies and the foundation that, you know, and the support that they provide through these other programs, that the GLRI itself, which is supposed to be supplementary, it's not supposed to replace funding from other programs. And so we just provided I have a chart here that I'll provide for you so you can get a feel for how those monies flow. The other thing this chart will demonstrate is the thing that has also been talked about is the great complexity of governance in this region. So we are talking about multiple federal agencies, multiple states, and other things. And so as the structure of the GLRI was put together, it really was to try to zero in on that and that complicated problem that the Government Accountability Office identified, I think back in 2003, which basically complained that there was no orchestra leader. There was no one in charge to kind of corral all of the various elements of what we needed to do to restore and protect the drinking water source for 30 million Americans. And so now we have that through the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. So as I noted, the NGOs are very involved. We're not governmental, obviously, so we have a bit of a different role. I would argue that many of my groups are very active in not the governmental side, but the implementation side. So my groups are really active. We have watershed groups, we have hunter and angler groups, we have all sorts of people that have been identified in, I think, one of the handouts in your folder. And they all bring to bear their local expertise on what the issues are in their communities and then what some of those solutions should be. They function, they apply for grants, they do projects on the ground, whether or not that's a beach remediation project or a wetland remediation project. Some of them are active in the areas of concern program by interfacing between the states and the local communities to help develop plans for how to get those areas of concern cleaned up. So there's a lot of different roles that non-governmental players play in terms of actually getting the work accomplished on the ground. The other role that we play is that we can advocate. So unlike some of the governmental partners who are not going to be quote-unquote advocates, we can, and we do. And so we are hopefully you have heard from either the coalition through myself or through our members about, you know, what is going great with Great Lakes Restoration, and we'll also tell you what we think needs to be improved as we head into the new Action Plan 3 process or as Congress may want to evaluate how the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative is working as it considers reauthorizing the program. The current GLRI authorization in Section 118 of the Clean Water Act expires in fiscal year 2021, and I know we as a coalition have already begun to think about and reflect on what's working and what's not and potential areas for improvement. Overall, we think it's going very well. And as Dave noted, we probably need more money. Actually, we don't probably need more money. We do need more money because the issues that we're facing are very, very large. But we really want to think critically about, you know, where we potentially could improve that, and we'll look forward to having that conversation with you all. So those are our views. You know, we do think, as I noted, that the GLRI has attempted to bring clarity to a very confusing situation between all the various federal agencies and how the federal agencies interact with the local folks, state, local, city, NGOs. The money has been incredibly important to bringing those people to the table. But I don't want you to walk away thinking that that's the only thing that's good about the GLRI. It is that structure that has been put into place, that discipline that it has forced on us, and the collaboration and cooperation that it has really engendered in the region that has allowed us to see the tremendous success that I know Matt Doss will be talking about through the research that they did last fall. So we're very excited about the program. I will, and I would love to answer any questions that you may have.
And now I'd like to introduce Matt Doss. He's the policy director of the Great Lakes Commission. Well, good afternoon. Thank you, everybody. Again, my name is Matt Doss, and I'm policy director for the Great Lakes Commission. And my colleague Victoria talked a little bit about who we are and what we do. Part of our formal mission is to advocate on behalf of the Great Lakes states with Congress and the federal government on issues of common interest. So I manage our policy and advocacy program. On the table out there was our 2019 congressional priorities. So hopefully you picked this up. And we bring this out every year to outline our top priorities for the region, and one of those is the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. So it's great to be able to be here and talk about that. I'm also really thrilled to be here because my first job out of college was working for a member of Congress in this very building. So I cut my teeth here and had a lot of great experiences and benefited from that. And because of that, I'm really aware of the challenges you face doing your job, the many different issues you have to cover, that huge, luxurious office that you have to decorate. That was a joke.
But seriously, we know that you have to cover a lot of issues. You're responding to sort of the crisis of the day. So, you know, we have always tried to convey our information in a way that really cuts to the chase and what the key issues are, and help you respond to constituents, help you equip your boss for handling these issues. And please use us as a resource together with all the colleagues up here. I can assure you that all of us will give you credible, accurate information. And if we don't have the answer, then we'll shoot you to where you need to go. So the title of this slide is something I hope you will keep in mind as I talk about the areas of concern, and that is the notion of going from remediation to revitalization. And there's actually a third step in there, restoration, and so we kind of call this the R cubed, remediation to restoration to revitalization. And the GLRI is really supporting the remediation, the cleanup of contaminated sediments and other sources of pollution. They're restoring habitat, restoring degraded shorelines, and then that in turn is leading to revitalization, that sort of economic revitalization, economic growth, bringing people back to our waterfronts that we're starting to see more and more of. And really what the GLRI is doing is helping to create the enabling conditions for this. So I just want you to keep that concept in mind. I'm going to move on here. So the areas of concern, what are they? These are the most heavily degraded, environmentally degraded areas on the Great Lakes. And actually, you'll see that they were sort of formally associated with the amendment to the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement in 1987. But actually, the states and the provinces, together with the federal government and the International Joint Commission, started identifying these problem areas in the 70s. And staff would come together and look across the basin to see where these problem areas were. And eventually, they narrowed those down to 43 areas of concern. And those were that program, the Area of Concern program, was formally established in the 1987 Water Quality Agreement. And those areas are based on having one or more of 14 beneficial use impairments. And these are basically impaired uses, like you can't eat the fish, you can't swim, you can't drink the water without doing special treatment. And, of course, nobody drinks water generally straight out of a river or bay. You do some kind of treatment. But the notion with restrictions on drinking water is that you have to do added treatment for it coming from an area of concern because of toxic contamination. So I'll talk a little bit more about those in a second. So ultimately, there were 43 areas of concern identified. There are 26 U.S. AOCs, 12 Canadian AOCs, and 5 binational AOCs. So those are AOCs that are on connecting channels like the Detroit River and the St. Mary's River and the St. Clair River and the Niagara River. And I'll talk a little bit about more of those in a second. So the point here is that there is one or more area of concern in each of the 8 Great Lakes states. So all of you, you may not necessarily have one in your district. You probably do, but your boss represents a district and a state. All the Great Lakes states have at least one AOC. So this is a program that touches on all the states, and it's also a program that really is at the heart of the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. And in fact, when we think about restoration, restoring the Great Lakes, the areas of concern is where the rubber hits the road, because these are the most heavily degraded areas. So the AOC program is administered by USEPA out of the Great Lakes National Program Office, and in partnership with state environmental agencies and local public advisory councils. And EPA and Chris's office manages the overall program. They receive the funding from Congress, and then they kind of set up the framework for getting funding out to other projects and programs. But a lot of the real implementation work is done by the states. And that's by design, because the states have the staff on the ground. They have the best sort of local knowledge about where those problems are. And so, you know, a lot of the work is done by the state. So your states have a heavy investment in this program, both with their staff and funding, as well as just the kind of moral commitment to cleaning up these areas that are really in their backyards. So these are the areas of concern. As I said, there's at least one in each state. Starting here in Illinois, we have Waukegan Harbor, just north of Chicago. Wisconsin has 4 areas of concern: Milwaukee, Sheboygan, Fox River, Southern Green Bay. Actually, 5. Lower Menominee River, this is shared with the state of Michigan, it's on the border. And then the St. Louis River, which is shared with Minnesota. Minnesota has 1, St. Louis River.
And so it's Superior, Wisconsin on the Wisconsin side and Duluth, Minnesota on the Minnesota side. Michigan has 14 areas of concern, so more than any other state. Is anybody here from Michigan? All right, great. So huge, huge program for Michigan. We have Kalamazoo River, Muskegon Lake, White Lake. In the Upper Peninsula, again, the Menominee River shared with Wisconsin. Manistique River, Deer Lake, Torch Lake, St. Mary's River. St. Mary's River is one of the bi-national areas of concern shared with Canada. And then Saginaw River, St. Clair River, another bi-national area of concern. Clinton River, Detroit River, another bi-national AOC. Rouge River and the River Raisin. Ohio has four AOCs, Maumee River, Black River, Cuyahoga River, and Ashtabula River. And does anybody know what happened 50 years ago this June on the Cuyahoga River? Anybody know? Caught on fire. And that was a really historic event because rivers are not supposed to catch on fire, right? Well, the Cuyahoga River caught on fire, and it actually, a lot of big industrial rivers had fires back in those days. So it's the most famous. I think there was a famous cover on Life magazine. But the Rouge River, Buffalo River, they all had fires because there was so much chemicals and trash and stuff in the river. But that was important because it caught a lot of public attention, and it really was one of the impetuses to the development of the Clean Water Act. Moving on, Pennsylvania has one AOC, the Presque Isle Bay, and New York has six, Buffalo River, Niagara River, the bi-national AOC, 18 Mile Creek, Rochester Embayment, Oswego River, and the St. Lawrence River. So this is a really big deal. These are across the region, and they really represent, you know, the industrial heartland of the United States and the most heavily degraded industrialized areas of our region. So these are the 14 beneficial uses that I mentioned. I'm not going to read these. You can look at them. And you can see that this really covers the full gamut of environmental problems. And so, again, what this reflects is beneficial uses that we want to have from these waterways, but that are impaired because of pollution. And a lot of these align in some ways with the Clean Water Act. And the Clean Water Act is based on the fundamental desire to have waters that are fishable, swimmable, and drinkable, along with healthy habitats. So most of these can kind of be aligned with one of those high-level desired uses for our waterways. Now, the AOCs, some of them have all 14, but most of them have a subset of these. They didn't have to have all 14 of these to be considered an area of concern. So where are we with the areas of concern? As I said, there was a lot of planning and identifying them that went up in the 70s and 80s, and then the program really kind of was formally established in 1987. Progress was pretty slow for a long time. There was a lot of planning was done, a lot of testing and sampling and trying to identify the nature and extent of the environmental problems. But there also wasn't a lot of money. Until the GLRI came along, there really wasn't a lot of money to really start doing on-the-ground work, moving mud, and doing cleanups. Since the GLRI, we have seen huge progress. And as I mentioned, really the major focus of the GLRI is on the areas of concern. About $800 million has been spent so far. Roughly, on average, roughly a third of GLRI funding goes to the areas of concern. We've had four AOCs delisted, and that's a term we use to mean that all the cleanup work has been done and the impaired uses have been restored, and we can take those AOCs off the list of areas of concern. One of those AOCs was delisted prior to the GLRI. Three have been formally delisted since that time, and we'll see those in a minute. Eight AOCs have had all their management actions completed, and what we mean by management actions is just the management actions are all the things they need to do to clean up the AOC, and that can be cleaning up contaminated sediments, restoring habitat, restoring degraded shorelines that are hardened with riprap and sheet pile and things of that nature. So it can be anything like that. So it's sort of a generic term. And this is one of the criteria that EPA tracks under the GLRI is how many AOCs have completed their management actions. Now, one of the distinctions here is that you might be able to complete all the cleanup work, but you may not be able to formally delist the AOC because you need to do some monitoring for a number of years. Sometimes the environment needs time to sort of naturally restore itself for fish and wildlife habitat to come back, for sedimentation to come in and cover up contaminated sediments, different things like that. So
But basically what it means is you've done all the work you need to do, and it just takes time for the environment to respond or for agencies to kind of do that monitoring to make sure that those uses have been restored. We have removed about 85 beneficial use impairments out of a total of 255 for the U.S. AOCs. We've removed about 3 million cubic yards of contaminated sediments. And contaminated sediments really are probably one of the core environmental problems in the areas of concern. And these are areas where we've had pollution, chemicals, PCBs, hydrocarbons from power plants or refineries or paper mills, chemicals that have gotten into the sediments in a river or a bay or a harbor, and they just sit there. And so the generic term is contaminated sediments, and they are, as I said, probably the most significant environmental problem in the AOCs. They're a major driver for most of the beneficial use impairments, and they're also a significant obstacle to development, because if you've got contaminated sediments, you can't dredge the harbor to make it deeper. You can't dredge it to create a marina. You're likely to have restrictions on fish consumption, swimming, and other things of that nature. And so getting that sediment out is really important to be able to do all those things. So again, contaminated sediments is a major challenge, very complex, very expensive, and that's why a lot of the funding under the GRI has been going toward cleaning up contaminated sediments. Now, this program you're going to see here called the Great Lakes Legacy Act, this is a program that actually predated the GRI. It was a program that Congress passed in 2002, and it was specifically directed at providing funding for cleaning up contaminated sediments. It's a cost-share program that provides up to 65% of the cost for cleaning up contaminated sediments at a site, with 35%, a minimum of 35% required to be provided by a non-federal sponsor. In some cases, the non-federal sponsor are states where they have an environmental bond program or they provide an appropriation, particularly for sites that we call orphan sites where there's no responsible party. In other words, you know, the industries that might have caused this have been gone for decades, and there's just no way to point a finger at someone and say, hey, you know, you have some responsibility for this site. In other cases, industries have stepped up and provided that cost share. And this happens where industries recognize that they probably have some liability. This is a way for them to come in and put up that cost share and get that work done and, you know, get out from under that liability. And the Legacy Act program has been tremendously successful. As I said here, we've removed about 3 million cubic yards of sediments. We've leveraged over $300 million from non-federal partners, again, as a part of that cost share. And it's a very efficient program. It avoids a lot of the lengthy litigation that you see with Superfund and some other programs. And it's just done a lot of great work. So it's a real success story. Prior to the GLRI, Congress appropriated money for the Legacy Act separately as a separate line item each year. That money went to GLNPOW, and then they administered it under that program. Since the GLRI started, basically GLNPOW gets $300 million, and they fund Legacy Act sediment cleanups out of that money, depending on what the needs are from year to year. And just one little factoid, just to give you a sense of the ongoing need in this area, they have continued to work with the states and industries and local communities to identify sediment sites, characterize them, and develop cleanup plans. In FY20, EPA predicts that they're going to need about nearly $90 million, I think, for Legacy Act cleanups. So that is just one part of AOC cleanup. There's also the habitat restoration and other things. And that, of course, is just one part of the larger GRI program. So that just gives you a sense of the ongoing need in this area. So these are the performance measures for the AOCs under the Action Plan 3 that Chris mentioned that is being developed now. It's going to be out for public review, I think, pretty soon. And this will guide the program for the next 5 years. So their performance measures are to remove half of the remaining BUIs, to complete management action lists for all the AOCs. And what this is, again, is each AOC needs to have a list of all the on-the-ground projects they need to implement to remove those BUIs. So we've got most of those completed, but not all of them. So the aim is, again, is to get management action lists completed for all the AOCs, and then finally to complete all management actions at five of 10 potential AOCs. So again, you'll notice that actual delisting is not a performance measure. It's completing all the management actions. So this is what EPA calls their bucket list. And one of the greatest things you've done, Chris. This is beautiful. So the red line is everything under Action Plan 2 that we're in right now is over here to the left of this red line. These are the AOCs that have been delisted, the 4, the 8, that they've had all management actions completed. And then these are the ones that they're aiming to complete all the management actions yet this year. So moving forward, beginning in 2020 through 2024, these are the 10 AOCs that EPA is going to be focusing on. And they'll continue to do work in all of them, but these are the ones where there's really potential for significant progress. And the aim is to complete all the cleanup work and management actions in 5 of these. So a lot of work yet to be done, and it's worth noting that, you know, some of these ones in here are smaller AOCs with sort of smaller problems, if you will. As we move forward, some of these are really, really dirty AOCs, big, heavily industrialized with more significant problems. So these were, some of these are sort of the low-hanging fruit. We're getting into some really challenging ones here, the Rouge River, Grand Cal River, just Cuyahoga River. So, you know, just because we've kind of finished some doesn't mean that the magnitude of the problem is going down proportionally. Okay, so I want to move on to a study that we did last year. And basically what we wanted to do is it came out of this notion of what's the economic value of the Great Lakes. We know that the Great Lakes have been a driver for our economy. We know that the GLRI anecdotally is having some economic impacts. But no one had really done a comprehensive study of the economic impact of the GLRI. Dave mentioned a study done by Brookings Institution in 2004, 2005.
No, 2007 or 8.
2007 or 8. And that was sort of looking ahead, if we were to spend this money, what would we get from it? So what our study did was we looked at the GLRI spending from 2010 to 2016. So actual spending, actual dollars that were spent during that time. And we wanted to ask, what was the economic impact of that? Now, the GLRI is not an economic development program. It's an environmental restoration program. So it's not intended specifically to promote economic development. And EPA didn't really track economic impacts because that's not what the program is intended to do. We know anecdotally, though, we're seeing in these waterfront areas where they're doing these cleanups, we're seeing new economic activity develop. So we wanted to ask ourselves, well, what is the economic impact of the program? So we had an integrated study approach that did an econometric analysis of GLRI project spending from 2010 to 2016, regional economic modeling, projecting the future impacts of that spending through 2036. And then we did a number of case studies to try to illustrate kind of the real-world impact of that spending. We had an economics research team from University of Michigan. We had a panel of regional economists that kind of advised us, almost like a peer review panel that advised us on the methodology. We had a larger advisory panel of regional stakeholders that advised us on the project. And then we had a team that did the case studies. These are the case study locations. And again, these are areas of concern. So these are areas where there's been substantial GLRI spending. And we've got summaries of each of these case studies on the table back there, so please pick one up, particularly for your state or if you happen to represent one of these communities. And our results were, and I should say that some of these results kind of seem sort of simple, but there's a really rigorous economic analysis behind this. I mean, this is really hardcore stuff. It's very credible. This is really the only regional study of the GLRI's economic impact that has been done to date, really looking at what's been a result of the funding that has been spent to date. So what we found was that the every dollar spent on GLRI projects from 2010 to 2016 is going to generate about $3.35 in additional economic activity through 2036. So another 20 years of economic activity resulting from that spending. In some of the communities, particularly the larger ones like Buffalo and Detroit, that return on investment was closer to $4, again, over the next 20 years. A lot of that economic impact is coming from increases in tourism. And this makes sense because we're creating conditions where people can come back to the waterfront, so they can kayak and waterboard, paddleboard, and fish. And it's easier.
No waterboarding.
Right.
No.
And it facilitates economic development that might not have been possible beforehand. And so we're really seeing a lot of people wanting to come back to these waterfront areas. Also, we looked at the changes in housing values, and we're able to identify that about every dollar in GRI spending increased housing values by about $1.08. And really what this is kind of a surrogate for a quality of life. It's hard to measure quality of life. So if people are willing to pay more for houses in an area where GRI money has been invested, we view that as kind of a surrogate, meaning that there's a higher quality of life there, that they're willing to pay more to live there because of those environmental improvements. And I'm not going to read some of these little details here. These are in the case studies, and you'll see them. But basically, some of the themes that we heard from our stakeholder interviews were that the GRI has been a catalyst that's helped stimulate new real estate and commercial development, particularly in waterfront areas that have been degraded for a long time. It's helped communities improve their awareness and their access to waterfronts and water resources. It's deepened perceptions of community and created some sense of optimism for developing areas that, you know, had kind of heretofore been sort of like considered degraded and sort of part of the Rust Belt. It's helping communities tackle problems that they didn't think that they could really tackle on their own. I mean, the magnitude and the scale of these problems is really greater in most cases than what most communities can tackle on their own. So it's really helped them make progress in areas where they weren't able to make progress before. And finally, it's generated growth in the tourism sector and starting to change perceptions about the value of the water-based resources in these communities. So just real quickly, this was our study team, Council of Great Lakes Industries, the Great Lakes Commission, National Wildlife Federation, University of Michigan Water Center, Alliance for the Great Lakes, Michigan Office of the Great Lakes, and the Great Lakes Metro Chambers Coalition. And I need to recognize our funders, the Mott Foundation, the Wege Foundation, Joyce Foundation, the Erb Family Foundation, Michigan Office of the Great Lakes, Pennsylvania, and the Fund for Lake Michigan. So that's it. And I know I've been talking fast, but I'm probably at the end of our time, so I'm going to stop.
If anybody has any questions on any of the GLRI presentations, you're open to them. If not, I think we'll move on to talking about invasive species. We have several really good panelists. First, we will have Dr. Mark Gayden, who's with the Great Lakes Fishery Commission, kind of give a big picture of invasive species within the region. Then we will move on to getting a federal perspective and Aaron Wolt with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services, and then we will hear from the Alliance for the Alliance for the Great Lakes, which is an NGO that's specifically focused on a lot of environmental and specifically invasive species and water quality issues. And we have Shada and Sansari. So Mark.
Okay. Thanks very much. So, yes, we're going to shift gears a bit to talk about invasive species. I'll guarantee your bosses will, you and your bosses will encounter this issue. I'm going to speak at the 40,000-foot level to set up some of the presentations for my colleagues. We're going to talk about some other invasive species, including our favorite poster child, Asian carp. But invasive species are really the scourge of the Great Lakes. They're ecologically and economically costly. And I'm going to give a brief overview, really, of why what they are, why we're concerned about them, and then what we're doing about them, too. The Great Lakes, in some respects, at least from an invasive species perspective, are blessed in having seals, if you will, from other watersheds at two ends. One is, of course, Niagara Falls, which is a barrier to upstream migration of fish, a pretty significant barrier. There's no fish that can jump that. And then outside of the city of Chicago, really probably running right downtown Chicago, is a subcontinental divide that separates the Great Lakes watershed from the Mississippi watershed. We have breached both of these, and so we have thus opened up the Great Lakes to invasive species. The irony
Everything that you've been hearing about from the, you know, the water quality agreement of the early 1970s and the big laws like the Clean Water Act and the great work that's going on with the GLRI and others to clean up the Great Lakes and these areas of concern. The irony is that when you make habitat improved for the species that are in the lakes, you're also creating habitat, good habitat for species that you don't want in. And that's how the spread occurs. This is why invasive species is a growing problem. And it's a problem that we have to deal with. Climate change only makes the Great Lakes more hospitable even to a wider range of species. I'm going to talk mostly about aquatic invasive species, but because that's what I do. But everything that I talk about could relate as well to, say, terrestrial species, and I'll talk a little bit about some of those. So keep in mind in the Great Lakes we have native species and non-native species. And the native species, some of the big native species that we have in the lakes are, say, lake trout, lake whitefish, sturgeon, walleye, yellow perch, sculpins, and ciscos are on the forage fish, so they're native fish that are eaten by the bigger fish. And then those last two at the bottom, mysis, diapria, two examples of zooplankton species that are integral to the food web, being at the very bottom of the food web. When I talk about non-native species, there's two types. One we generally call naturalized species, or and I'm being over general, but these are species that, for the most part, were purposefully introduced into the Great Lakes. You might be surprised to know that most of the salmon, unless you're in Lake Ontario with Atlantic salmon, most of the salmon in the Great Lakes are Pacific salmon that were introduced starting in the 1960s and continuously introduced through hatchery programs that all of the states and the provinces run. It's a very popular fishery, but these salmon are non-native to the Great Lakes. It was a leap of faith that they made in the 60s to try and do that, create the fishery. Brown trout, common carp brought in the 1800s by people from Europe who wanted a little slice of home. Atlantic salmon, native to Lake Ontario, of course, but has been naturalized or introduced into parts of the upper Great Lakes. It's a wonderful fish, but not native beyond Niagara Falls. And then really the subject of what I'm talking about are invasive species. And these are species that, for the most part, are accidentally introduced into the Great Lakes, and they get there in a number of ways that I'll talk about. Sea lamprey, being the baddest of them all, came into the Great Lakes in the 1800s, Lake Ontario, and then 1920s. But the other big ones, zebra and quagga mussels, you hear a lot about. Zebra and quagga mussels were introduced starting about the late 1980s, 88, I want to say, and started the second wave of concern about invasive species and the effects of that still being understood. Alewife, round goby, some of the others. I have a little star on grass carp, where grass carp are stocked in parts of the United States, but not in the Great Lakes, but we've seen them make their way into the system. And they're supposed to be sterile, but we're not finding that's the case, actually. So we don't know if we're on the edge of an invasion or just seeing more because we're looking harder. And then those ones at the bottom, spiny water fleas, fishhook fleas, bloody red shrimp. Again, this is exotic zooplankton at the bottom of the food web that is pretty much displaced some of these other species that are better. And one thing that I'll say is that, in general terms, Mother Nature does it better. When something comes into the lakes, they haven't evolved with the fish that are there. They're often not as suitable to the habitat. They're often very good at eking out what was there. And you might have increased biodiversity, but if you think of your garden, if you don't tend it, let the weeds grow in there, you might have a lot of weeds, but it wasn't the, say, the carrots or whatever you had planted there or that's native in the system, and often not as good. Invasive plants, this is the only plant that I'll talk about, again, because I don't know much about this issue, but Phragmites, which is up there, you see that's really grown in the Great Lakes region, displacing some wetlands plants, for example, and growing along roadways. If you're a lead foot like I am, the police like to hide behind them too, so it has that effect as well of being good cover for predators. Reed canary grass, purple loosestrife, and so on and so forth. Some of them aquatic weeds and plants that get into the system. How do they get here? Well, there are four main vectors that I'll talk about. One is ballast water. Ships need ballast to be stable. Ballast weighs them down in the water. You don't want a top-heavy ship that's tipping. So often when a ship is coming from a foreign port, it'll take on ballast water in that port. The water being a stabilizing thing sits in a tank. And then when they get to the port to take on cargo, say in the Great Lakes, Toledo, or wherever you want to be, Duluth, Superior, they'll discharge the ballast water and take on the cargo, which then serves as ballast. What happens, however, is that that ocean voyage, that voyage from Toledo up to Duluth or whatever, can be just perfectly fine for organisms that might get sucked into that ballast tank when they're taking on the water. So these aquatic hitchhikers hitch a ride, and that's how they get into the lakes. Since the opening of the St. Lawrence Seaway, and certainly since the water quality improvements in the system, we've seen a whole number of ballast water invaders, and some of the poster children for that, spiny water flea, round goby, bloody red shrimp, zebra mussels, and so on. Ballast is now governed by the Coast Guard authorization, which passed in the last Congress. Like Matt, I'm a former congressional staffer. Back in 1988, my boss had worked on the very first response to zebra mussels called the Non-Indigenous Aquatic Nuisance Prevention and Control Act. I can't believe that I'm standing here in 2019 and saying just last year, probably the biggest ballast water legislation, and hopefully the final response to it, at least in federal law, has been done. It was done under what's called the Vessel Incidental Discharge Act. And that's what governs the ballast water. Canada's coming in alignment as well. So I think for the first time ever, the two countries are pretty close to alignment on the ballast water. Another vector are canals and waterways. This is how the sea lamprey got in through the Welland Canal, which bypasses Niagara Falls and made it through then out the Great Lakes. Asian carp, which my colleagues are going to talk about, threaten the Great Lakes through canals and waterways, particularly in the Chicago area. And other invasive species could swim their way in through these canals and waterways. Governance of canals and waterways is ad hoc. The Asian carp issue, for example, is done through a self-formed group called the Asian Carp Regional Coordinating Committee. There's probably 20 plus agencies that are a part of that because there's a lot of folks that have a role to play in the Chicago area waterway. But there's no single law or governing structure for dealing with this as a vector. So governance is a little difficult, really, to point to who is in charge of keeping invaders out via the canals and waterway vector. The movement of live organisms, or the trade of live organisms, is another vector. This is a national problem. The Everglades are under threat from Burmese pythons, which were brought in as pets and released. Snakeheads, you've probably heard about, lionfish, and then our friend the Asian carp. So Asian carp not only through waterways, canals and waterways, but also potentially through the trade of live organisms. This would be, say, rearing them in a aquaculture facility in one part of the country and transporting them through to another part, whether it's for sale at a fish market or accidentally mixed in with bait fish or the like. The trade of live organisms is, again, done ad hoc, primarily through the states, which have the ability to put together a dirty list, and also through a federal law called the Lacey Act. Lacey Act is about a 100-year-old law that has an injurious provision. If your species is listed as injurious, there are some things the federal government can do to prevent the interstate movement of that. But that's, again, that's about it with respect to that. There's some inspections at the border when they come in, but it's really, really weak. And it really needs to be done better. Organisms for importation, for all intents and purposes, are deemed innocent until you can prove they're guilty. And that's, unfortunately, the wrong approach. By the time you can prove that they're causing harm, there's nothing you can do about it. And then finally, recreational activities. This is boats, say, moving from one water body to another is the final really big vector. This is could also be like you see on the prop there, zebra mussels encrusted onto a boat prop, or types of shiners or little fish that might be moved around in bait. The states have lots of laws in place with respect to bait. Sea Grant has work that they do on helping boaters, and the Lacey Act as well would apply to that. But again, it's very ad hoc. You might see a theme here. I keep saying the word ad hoc. Except for lamprey control, which is the responsibility of the Great Lakes Fishery Commission under the treaty that Dave Ulrich talked about, there really is no one entity that has the responsibility or the authority to deal with invasive species writ large. Why do we care? Because it's economically costly. It's ecologically costly as well, but economics, it tends to be the arguments that get people's attention. There are tens of thousands of species that get moved around, that get imported, that get make their way into public waterways. Economics are inherently difficult, but it's in the billions, according to economists from Cornell University and other places, and they do threaten species and some species at risk. Why should we care about aquatic invasive species? Well, we have more than 189 native species in the Great Lakes. Not all are invasive. Remember, some of them are naturalized that came in, but so a lot of them are, and a lot of them are very costly. So we have 180 plus non-native species in the Great Lakes, but only two can be controlled at a basin-wide level. One is the alewife. That's a small herring-like fish that got into the Great Lakes accidentally. The alewife are controlled by stocking those Pacific salmon I talked about. So you introduce the salmon partially to keep the alewives under control. These used to die off in the hundreds of millions and stink up the beaches. The other is the sea lamprey under the treaty. Part of the reason why lamprey can be controlled is somebody's in charge. The other reason is there are techniques, actually, we got lucky and found in the 1950s that control lamprey. So why do we care about AIS? Because we'll be stuck with the problem if we don't do something to keep them out of the Great Lakes in the first place. They are permanent fixtures in the system, and decisions that are made by fishery managers or others will always have to take these harmful species into account. What does the future hold, just in conclusion? Number one, prevention. That's the key. You got to prevent it in the first place, because otherwise you're not going to have much of a chance to do anything. In the likelihood that you do have techniques, control can be done. You can innovate and find new methods. A lot of the GLRI money for Asian carp, for example, is trying to find some innovative ways to deal with the problem. Establish laws and regulations to close those gaps that I've mentioned. More monitoring is important. You got to know where they are if you're going to take some action, and maybe even be ready to conduct rapid response. Let me leave you with this last slide, too. And Matt, are you going to make the slides available?
Yes.
Okay. So you don't have to scribble this down, but here are some wonderful resources about invasive species. On the lamprey control, just I'll give myself top billing here because this is what we do. If you want to learn about lamprey and control, sealampreycontrol.org. NOAA has a website that's pretty thorough. It's taxonomic about the invaders and how they get here. So if you're ever curious how the ghost shiner got here or whatever. USGS has a phenomenally good website on invasive species with maps and all that shows the current range of the invaders. I'll suggest that it's a perfect resource for you when your boss runs out and says, where are Asian carp right now? And you can make that map in about 2 minutes and really impress your boss. Great Lakes Commission has some good stuff online, National Invasive Species Council, and there's an NGO, the Reduced Risk from Invasive Species, that also has some good resources. So with that, I'll turn it over to my colleagues who will talk a little bit about the federal response to that, and also then we'll dive into Asian carp. And I thank you very much for your attention.
Next, we have Aaron Wolt with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He'll be able to discuss the federal response to invasive species and some of the work that his agency's doing.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thanks, everyone, for
being here. I know we're throwing a lot of information at you, and it's getting late in the day, but we've got more stuff coming, so here we go. And I will say, as a University of Michigan alumnus, the slide cup, the color scheme for my slides seemed like a good idea until that NCAA basketball game last night. Now I think maybe they should be red and white. But anyway, we'll move on quickly. So Great Lakes AAS, I'll just build off of where Mark started. Currently, it depends on how you count them. There's, Mark said, 180, 185, you know, depends on how you count them. There's a lot of aquatic invasive species in the Great Lakes Basin, which is a primary threat to what? To a Great Lakes fishery, and this is just a recreational fishery in U.S. waters only, that's valued in excess of $7 billion. And that's actually a low number. That's an older statistic. It's probably above $10 billion, actually, but it's a big number, right? So billions of dollars. The good news is that the overall rate of AIS introductions have slowed since ballast water regulation, but still, we've got over 180 out there. And there's a key threat right now exists from Asian carp expansion. So when I say Asian carp, or we say Asian carp, what do we mean? It's four species of concern that originate on the continent of Asia. And those are silver carp and bighead carp, which are planktivores. So they're filter feeding both phytoplankton and zooplankton out of the water column. Grass carp, which are herbivores and eat aquatic vegetation, and black carp, which are molluscivores, so those are eating our native mussels. These fish were all brought into the country at one point legally in the 60s and 70s to control vegetation and to control mollusks in aquaculture ponds, and they escaped during flood events and got out into our surface waters, and once they got into the Mississippi River, they had a freeway to go pretty much all throughout the country. So there's an Asian carp that is actually a bighead carp, so you can see that species gets quite large. Range expansion in the U.S., what do I mean by that? So bighead and silver carp populations are now considered widely established in the Mississippi River Basin, and I'll show you some maps here in a second to give you an idea what that looks like. Grass and black carp populations are increasing, and there's some evidence that they're now reproducing in the wild, which is something that we were hoping not to ever find. So silver carp expansion, I don't know how well these show up, but these are all snapshots over time. The red dots are fish captures, and it starts from Louisiana to the south, and you've got Wisconsin and Minnesota all the way to the top. So if you look at these over time, for silver carp, in 2000, silver carp were found in about 16 states, and by 2016, they were in 22 states. The next map is bighead carp expansion, and you can see the general kind of spread of expansion is from south to north. Then once they get up into the Mississippi River and the Ohio River basins, they kind of break off east and west as well. So bighead carp were in 23 states in 2000, and by 2016 they were in 28 states for bigheads. Black carp were a little bit more contained. In 2000 they were in one state. Now in 2016 they're in six states. I do not have a progression map to show you for grass carp, but if you know anything about grass carp, you know that they've spread further than the others that I've just shown you, including into the waters of the Great Lakes. So why are Asian carp a problem? Who knows the answer to that one? This is one of the reasons why. So silver carp, these are all silver carp, jump when they're startled, and they can injure or hit people on or near the water. Ecologically, they directly compete with native fish and mussels for food, and they also displace native species. There's areas in the United States where they become 90% of the biomass. They just crowd everything else out, and they become 90% of the biomass in the water. They are direct predators on things like native mussels. They destroy aquatic habitat, which we care about for our native species. And those cumulative impacts, again, threaten both commercial and recreational fishing industries in U.S. and Canadian waters that have a high economic value. So what are we doing about it? So someone earlier today, I think a couple of group folks have already mentioned the Asian Carp Regional Coordinating Committee. That committee started in 2009. It was started because of the spread of bighead and silver carp towards the Great Lakes, which that's really led to the formation of the ACRCC. It currently has over 30 U.S. and Canadian federal, state, and provincial and local partners. So it is a true partnership that pulls from almost all segments of government. There are two co-leads right now for the ACRCC, one from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and one from EPA. The ACRCC annually implements a science-based integrated action plan. Many of you have seen those, and if you haven't seen them, you can get them on asiancarp.us. It used to be called, in the early days, it was called the Control Strategy Framework. Now it's called the Action Plan. And that action plan is aimed at preventing the establishment of Asian carp species in the Great Lakes. These are most of the partners that are in the ACRCC. We probably missed a few because there are so many. I don't want to read them all off because if I do, one, it'll take time, and two, I'll miss somebody. But there's some, you know, pretty key partners in there, like I said, from EPA, USGS, Army Corps of Engineers, Department of Fisheries and Oceans Canada, almost every state DNR you can think of that has waters anywhere near the Great Lakes or the Ohio River or the Mississippi River, the Ontario Ministry of Natural Resources, Quebec's Ministry of Sustainable Development, the Great Lakes Commission, the City of Chicago, so that we even have cities in there, the Great Lakes Fishery Commission, and even the Tennessee Valley Authority. So lots and lots of partners to make this thing move forward. The mission of the ACRCC is simply to prevent the introduction, spread, and establishment of Asian carp into the Great Lakes. There's lots of subgroups and subcommittees under the ACRCC, like the Communications Work Group, the Monitoring and Response Work Group, which is where a lot of the activity happens there. There's a Federal Executive Committee as well. Again, that annual action plan comes out every year, and so it's a pretty large document, summarizes all the proposed actions and projects that are funded by the ACRCC partners. The 2019 action plan will be released very soon. I was told on the way here it has now cleared OMB review, and the briefing will soon be coming for the congressional staff and congressional offices after that. That action plan, if you've never seen one, and like I said, I think they're all on asiancarp.us with the exception of FY19 because, we haven't fully released that yet. But it contains projects that are focused on some of the key areas that Mark mentioned earlier, like prevention, control, monitoring, early detection, pathway closures, research and development, so new tools that we can use in the fight, stakeholder communications. The action plan is supported both through the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, which you've heard a lot about, and through agency-based funds. Roughly, in terms of GLERI, it's varied from year to year, but it's between $16 and $20 million of GLERI funding out of that total $300 million you've heard, so that's a substantial investment from the GLERI funds. And then it's a larger number for when you put all the agency-based funds together. And it supports that one of the key importances of that action plan, too, is it supports the broader goals of the National Asian Carp Plan, which we'll get into in a second. So one of the things that we do with all of this work through the ACRCC is we put together maps like this. And so these maps, I know they're hard to read from there. These are available online as well. What this really is a what we call a leading edge map. And what it kind of shows, starting down in the south where you see red, is we are able to, by compiling all the data that we have and that we get through the action plan, we can identify areas where, like that red area where we consider carp, Asian carp established, meaning we have all life stages there. Then there's that, it's an orange and yellow area where we've got some adults and maybe some spawning going on. And then you get up past that into the green area, which kind of shows you there's some adults there, but really there's nearly no signs of spawning that we can measure. So we put this together, this map. It's a, like I said, it's a leading edge map. Some folks call it a risk map, too, just to show you from year to year how close these fish are getting to the Great Lakes. And, of course, one of the big landmarks on there is that star, which is the electric dispersal barriers, which we'll talk about here in the next slide, that are operated by the Army Corps of Engineers and sit about 37 river miles from Lake Michigan. So let's jump into those right quickly if you aren't not too knowledgeable about those. The electrical barriers in the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal are one of our important lines in the sand in the fight against Asian carp, trying to protect the Great Lakes. It's actually a system of barriers. There's currently three operating barriers in there, again, operated by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. A fourth barrier is under construction right now. They're, again, 37 miles from Lake Michigan. The importance of these barriers is this. They keep constant electricity in the water, which deters Asian carp, deters other fish as well, but it allows commercial transit of barges through that area. So it's not a, you know, it's not a complete wall, but it deters the fish and allows transit of other cargo through there. Essentially, if fish get too close to it, it shocks them, knocks them back, and they go back the other direction. Another thing we do under the action plan and through the ACRCC is we look at alternative pathways. So there's many alternative pathways. This is a depiction of one of them that we've invested a lot of time in recently. So this is a look at a couple barges parked together, and what you see where the stern of one barge comes into the bow of the other, you see kind of a little space between there that you see some tiny little dots in there that says retained fish. One thing we've found through studies over the last couple of years is that when barges run up and down through the Chicago area waterways and through other areas as well, small fish and eggs can get in there. It becomes kind of a slack area. They sit in there, they can stay in there, and those fish can be retained in there and can be moved long distances up to 10 miles and even through lockages and, yes, even across the electrical barrier. So I did not just say that Asian carp are being transported this way, because we have no evidence of that. What I've said was that small fish and eggs can be transported in that manner, which makes us a little concerned and makes us want to look and see if there's anything we can do about that. We have no evidence that Asian carp have gone by the barriers. However, we do know that this is a potential alternative pathway that we want to look into. And if you haven't seen any of these reports, they're available on asiancarp.us as well. Other alternative pathways, and by alternative pathways I mean other than direct swimming of the fish, include, and Mark mentioned some of these, inadvertent bait transfer, retention in bilgewater of vessels, aquaculture release, illegal movement of fish, mainly for the food market when we're talking about Asian carp. But anyway, this is an inadvertent pathway that we discovered a couple years ago that we're working with the barge industry to try to eliminate. Other things that go on under the ACRCC are what are referred to as seasonal intensive sampling efforts. Almost all of these have occurred in the Chicago area waterways, because that's where the ACRCC focuses. These are led by the Illinois Department of Natural Resources, because it is their waters, but we have help from almost all of the ACRCC agencies. And what these are 2 to 4 week long intensive sampling events in a particular area that we're concerned about. It includes thousands of person hours, miles and miles of nets, hours of electrofishing, all to go into an area and look and determine, do we have any Asian carp in the area? And these happen at least once a year, sometimes twice a year, depending on need, but all coordinated through the ACRCC, and in this case, like I said, with the guidance from Illinois DNR. Commercial harvest is also a tool that we use. So the states funded through it with ACRCC dollars, work with contract commercial fishers to intensely fish certain key locations. The goal there is to reduce stock sizes in defense of high priority choke points like the electric barriers. So to give you an idea of an example of what's going on in the cause, to date, contract fishers in Illinois have removed 8 million pounds of Asian carp. That's roughly a million fish. That's just the amount funded through the ACRCC and the GLURI process. If you look at their other total commercial landings, it's higher than that. But commercial fishing is one tool. It doesn't solve the issue, but it helps reduce pressure on certain key points. It's a difficult issue to talk about sometimes, because overall the goal of the national plan and the goal of the ACRCC is to extirpate Asian carp from the area. And so when you start having commercial markets develop, the idea is we do not want to develop an expectation of a sustainable market. We want to fish these things out. That's why it becomes a difficult topic to talk about, but it is effective. Okay, now that we've talked about many of the activities and the cause, I just want to broaden this out a little bit outside of the cause and the ACRCC and talk about, start segueing into the national plan. So this is a map you'll see in the Werder reports, and we'll talk about the Werder report here in a little bit. But again, it's that risk map that shows this expands out to the Mississippi River, the cause, which is that little branch that runs up through the Illinois River, and then also the Ohio River Basin and its tributaries like the Wabash River and the Tennessee River. Again, map similar to the one I showed before, where the red areas are where the fish are considered established. Those lighter shaded areas, those orange areas, are areas where we have some evidence of reproduction going on. And the blue areas are really where we don't really see reproduction, but we just kind of see rogue fish every now and then. So the national plan, which again helps steer efforts outside of the cause, was completed in 2007. And this was a really large undertaking from a whole suite of partners. There were over 70 state, federal, industry, academic, and non-governmental partners to put together this plan. It's roughly a couple hundred pages long. It has 7 common goals and objectives, as well as 48 supporting strategies and 113 recommendations for how we're going to achieve our goal and mission of controlling Asian carp on a national scale. And the overall goal of that is eradication of all but triploid fish in the wild. How we implement that, working with all of our partners, is that we step it down into basin-wide strategies. So the Asian Carp Action Plan for the cause is one of those basin-wide strategies. There are other strategies as well, like the Ohio River Basin has its own control strategy framework. individual states have their own state response plans, like Michigan and Minnesota have those plans, as well as others. And there's now an Upper Mississippi River Basin Action Plan being developed by the Upper Mississippi states, and actually a new Missouri River Plan as well. So the national plan is a way to comprehensively coordinate among all these jurisdictions on a national scale. Another development that happened was the Water Resources Reform and Development Act, or WRDA, in 2014. That was the act that directed, gave direction to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Army Corps of Engineers to lead a multi-agency effort to slow the spread of Asian carp in the Mississippi River and the Ohio River Basin. That's the one that requires an annual report to Congress. I think there's four of them out right now. Either that or the fourth one is just going to be coming out. It's either three or four, but those are available online as well on asiancarp.us. Those reports contain many things. It summarizes the activities of 20 partner agencies in these basins. It shows the observed changes in Asian carp distribution from year to year. It summarizes all of our activities, and it shows where all the funding is going, which is usually the table that everyone really, really likes to see. Beyond Asian carp, for a minute, just to step into those other 180 or so aquatic invasive species, the service and all of our state and provincial partners are implementing a Great Lakes Basin-wide early detection protocol that uses traditional sampling, so things like netting and trawling, targeting juvenile and adult fish, and also invertebrates. Mark showed you some invertebrates that are invasive, and also some genetic surveillance, which is our eDNA program, which I'll talk about here briefly in a second. Again, comprehensive Great Lakes Basin-wide. This has been ongoing since 2014. Would not be possible without the support of GLERI. GLERI is what really made this possible. So what this looks like is all of those red circles are areas where we intensely monitor for aquatic invasive species, again, in cooperation with our state partners and in many cases at the direction of our state partners. You know, Michigan may look at us and say we needed to sample Saginaw Bay this year. We have some strong concerns there. So we go and work with them and we do that. How do we pick these spots? Well, we pick them based on history of where invasive species have shown up. Some of them are picked based on where ballast water gets exchanged. Mark talked to you a little bit about ballast water. And some are based on pathway risk assessments. So that's a process, again, that was funded by GLERI and started back in 2010 for us that allowed the service and our partners to, right now, we've completed 1,000 of these risk assessment reports, and we have another 800 in progress. It's a rapid tool where you can look at a species, you can look at its history of invasiveness, you can look at its climate match for the area, you can determine is it a high probability for invasiveness or a low probability. What that does is it allows us to prioritize and pick those areas on the map with circles, allows us to, you know, to pick species that we're concerned about, and allows us to more fine-tune our early detection and monitoring system. Another tool that I briefly mentioned is genetic surveillance, or eDNA. This is a tool that was developed in cooperation with Army Corps of Engineers and USGS. And if I haven't given them a plug yet, I will. USGS does a lot of the research behind a lot of these new and novel techniques. They're a critical partner in all of this Asian carp work. But eDNA is a very sensitive tool that allows you to go out and collect water samples. You don't actually have to catch critters. You can go out and look for their sloughed genetic material. Right now, we only have markers available for bighead and silver carp, but grass carp, a marker for grass carp and black carp, both are quickly coming, and you can develop markers for any species that you care about, whether it's an invasive species or even a native species. Right now, roughly, the service goes out and at the direction of our state partners, samples about 8,000 water samples a year and processes them looking for presence of bighead and silver carp DNA. Switching gears, because you asked me to cover a lot of stuff. And I know I'm throwing a lot at you, but invasive mussels. I have one slide on mussels. Zebra and quagga mussels are an issue that you're going to hear about if you don't know about them already. They're distributed all across the Great Lakes. There's a map of zebra mussels on the left and quagga mussels on the right. You can see they're quite widely distributed. They got here in the late 1980s, presumably in ballast water. So one of the things that all of the partners are doing to help tackle this is there's been an invasive mussel collaborative established among government agencies, and that collaborative provides funding to help kind of advance some work into looking to control mussel species and looking to develop a control tool. Right now the issue is we don't have a control tool. And I know I'm just looking, I have gone over my time. I've got two slides on grass carp. I don't know if you want me to hit those or just...
And then
talked about a lot, so I think it's great.
All right. Well, we'll talk about grass. Well, thank you for that. That was tough. We'll talk to grass carp. Right now, the service budget, starting in FY18, our base budget included some direction from Congress that allowed us to open up some of that our Asian carp funding and use it to address grass carp issues. As I've told you before, they've spread into other they've spread most widely of all the four Asian carp species we're concerned about. So that direction in 2018, which carried over into our budget in 19, allows us to work with and support our state partners for grass carp work. So what we do with that is we support state and federal grass carp management actions in Lake Erie, which is usually focused in western Lake Erie. It allows us to evaluate use of deterrents, or you've heard some of these bubble barriers and sound barriers at key choke points, and it allows us to use certain states in the Ohio River Basin and the Upper Miss are interested in using contract fishing. So what we do again with our partners, both in the U.S. and in Canada, we focused in western Lake Erie. USGS does a lot of the key research to help us know where to look and know when these things are spawning and what habitats they're using. Ohio and Michigan, in this case, those DNRs help us pick the areas we're going to go in and respond. And then the service provides boats and crews to go out and look for these things. And one key finding in 2018 was there were some larval grass carp that were captured in the Maumee River. USGS was able to complete the genetic confirmation of those fish and confirm recently that those are grass carp. And so one of the issues there, or one of the key points there, is those are the first grass carp collected in the larval stage out in the Great Lakes. And with that, I will stop right there.
Now, Cato will be able to talk a little bit about some of the NGO responses, specifically to the silver and big head carp. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right. I can grab it. I think I saw it. This one? Nope. Yeah. There it is.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay, so I have good news. Mark and Aaron covered a lot of what I was going to cover, so I was worried about going too long in my presentation, but I think I can make it pretty short and sweet. So my name is Shada Essensherry. I'm the Water Policy Strategist at the Alliance for the Great Lakes. Thank you to the Institute for inviting us, and thank you all for coming. As Aaron just said, this is a lot of information. There will be a quiz at the end, so I hope you've been taking notes. Just kidding. So a little bit more about the Alliance. This is a map of the Great Lakes Basin. The Alliance is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization. We are headquartered in Chicago. And our work is broadly to advocate for protection and preservation of the Great Lakes. We use policy, education, and local efforts to ensure healthy Great Lakes for people and wildlife. I mentioned we're headquarters in Chicago. We do have offices across the region in New York, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Ohio. I just want to reiterate a few things that have already been said here. I'm going to try to not be too redundant, but some facts about the Great Lakes. You've heard that it is shared by two countries, the U.S. and Canada, eight states, two Canadian provinces, and many cities and local governments and tribal governments. This is, like I said, a map of the basin, so it's not only the lakes, but the surrounding rivers and streams. The Great Lakes cover 94,000 square miles of surface area and have 11,000 miles of coast. So just to give you an idea of, like, the resource that we're working with here and how valuable it is. Dave mentioned that one of the most important facts you can know about the Great Lakes is that it's the largest source of fresh surface water in the world. In North America alone, the Great Lakes make up 95% of the fresh surface water. That means that 40 million people in the region depend on the Great Lakes for their drinking water. We've heard a lot about the economic benefits of the Great Lakes in the region. There was a recent study focused on the socioeconomic impact of an invasion of grass carp in particular, and it found the total economic value of activity in or around the Great Lakes totaled $13 billion annually. So that comes from things like commercial and recreational fishing, hunting, recreational boating, beaches, and wildlife viewing. So just to put that in perspective, that would be greatly threatened by establishment of Asian carp and other invasive species in the Great Lakes. Just meant to go to that slide before. Asian carp. I'm going to just reiterate a few things here. So there are four main species of Asian carp: black grass, big head, and silver carp. They were introduced into the southern United States in the 1970s, and as Aaron said, they made their way up to up the Mississippi River and are getting quite close to the Great Lakes. Silver and bighead carp are now in the Illinois waterway, so they're close to striking distance to Lake Michigan. They're a problem because they grow quickly. They're able to reproduce multiple times a year. They're highly adaptable to new environments, and as has already been said, they're able to dominate an ecosystem and outcompete native fish for food. They can get up to 100 pounds and 6 feet tall. I know there was a photo of just how big they can get. And here's another picture of jumping carp. If you haven't YouTubed it, go ahead and YouTube it. So they're really a nuisance species. And when I talk about the economic benefits of recreation on the waterways, that would really be threatened by fish like this. I know you've already seen this map. I just want to draw your attention to a few things. So where are carp exactly? We know that in 2015, Asian carp larvae were found in the Dresden Island pool of the Des Plaines River, and Asian carp eggs were found in the Marseille and Starved Rock pools of the Illinois River. What I want to emphasize is in June 2017, a live silver carp was found in the Chago area waterway system, just 9 miles from Lake Michigan. This really drew a heightened response and concerned folks about the potential for carp to get into the Great Lakes. There was an autopsy conducted on the fish that was found, and they found that it actually grew up below that electric barrier system that's 37 miles from Lake Michigan, but it was found past the electric barrier system. So this indicates their ability to reverse the electric barriers. So another photo that you've already seen. So this is the electric barrier system that's 37 miles from Lake Michigan. Like has already been said, it's exactly what it sounds like. It's an electric current in the water that will deter fish from moving beyond it, or if they do move through it, it will render them unconscious and let them flow back downstream. But because of that live fish that was found just 9 miles from Lake Michigan, we know that these are not 100% effective. They do greatly reduce the incidence of fish moving towards Lake Michigan, or carp moving towards Lake Michigan, but we know that more needs to be done in order to ensure that no carp make it to the lake. So what's being done now? So a little bit of history. In 2007, Congress authorized the Army Corps to do a study looking at options for controlling Asian carp, as well as other aquatic invasive species, and they ordered them to include looking at hydrologic separation of the Great Lakes Basin and the Mississippi River Basin. So this study, the Glimmerus Report of the Great Lakes Mississippi River Interbasin Study, was finally released in 2014, and it included 8 options for controlling 13 invasive species, including carp, and the options range from the status quo, so no new federal action, just doing nothing about it, to that physical separation that I was talking about. The most expensive option for separation was estimated to cost about $18 million and take about 25 years to complete. So that was very quickly taken off the table. And so in 2014, the Army Corps was directed to look at control options and technologies at Brandon Road Lock and Dam as a viable alternative that would still allow vessel traffic on the waterway. So with physical separation, barges wouldn't be able to continue traversing. So that was 5 years ago. And another map to help you out here. So now all eyes are on Brandon Road near Juliet, Illinois, which is 47 miles from Lake Michigan. It's below the current electric barriers. Brandon Road was identified as a logical choke point, though I do want to highlight that it doesn't address two-way transfer. So the original GLMRS report was directed at looking at control of aquatic invasive species moving from the Great Lakes into the Mississippi River Basin, as well as from the Mississippi into the Great Lakes. Brandon Road really only deals with transfer of aquatic invasive species, carp in particular, moving towards the Great Lakes. But also a reminder that this was a compromise. So physical separation would have accomplished that issue with invasive species. But this compromise is intended to provide additional protections against Asian carp reaching the Great Lakes while still allowing barges to pass through. So this is a photo of Brandon Road, lock and dam. So the Brandon Road study was supposed to be released, the first draft of the study was supposed to be released in February of 2017, but the day before it was scheduled to be released, the Trump administration pulled it back. So even though Brandon Road was identified as a compromise, the shipping industry opposed the study because it didn't want any delays at Brandon Road lock. So like I said, it would still allow vessel traffic, but it would incur some delay. The shipping industry was able to influence the administration and stop the release of the study. So it ended up not being released until August after a live Asian carp was found only 9 miles from Lake Michigan, and Senator Durbin had language added to a Senate appropriations bill that would have ordered its release. Since then, they've released something called a tentatively selected plan, which was a draft version, and they've released a final draft late last year. And we've had two public comment periods, the second of which ended in February. The only major changes from, one of the only major changes from the initial draft to now was that the cost ballooned exponentially. So the project was originally supposed to cost $275 million when the draft was released in 2017, and it went up to $778 million. Why did that happen? So the current cost includes more than $300 million in something called contingency funding, so that's funding available for unknown incidences that could happen during construction. The Corps has built in that's a 66% contingency, rather than other projects average around 30%. So given the administration's lack of enthusiasm for the project, there are questions about whether this number is artificially inflated to try to make it look less desirable or what's going on there, but it is a little concerning that the contingency is so high. This is an image of the technologies that are being proposed to be implemented at Brandon Road Lock and Dam. It's a combination of non-structural and structural measures being proposed. These are the structural measures. Non-structural includes things like education and outreach, harvesting of fish, monitoring, things that are already ongoing. And then some of the structural measures include additional electric barriers, things like an acoustic fish deterrent, which is sound underwater to deter fish. If you go look at the report online, there's a pretty concise breakdown of what each of these technologies do and what they do to prevent Asian carp. So what's next? What's needed at the federal level? So what happens next with the Brandon Road study is the Army Corps will deliver its chief's report this year to Congress with recommendations for implementation of those protections that I just showed you at Brandon Road Lock and Dam. The next phase of the project is something called Pre-Construction Engineering and Design, or PED. And so Congress and the Corps must ensure that funding is available for FY20 for PED. The first year of PED requires $3.8 million in federal funds. PED is something that's estimated to take 3 years and cost about $28 million in total. About $18 million of that will come from the federal government, and $10 million needs to come from non-federal sources like the state of Illinois. Congress did ask the Corps to make funding available for this in FY19, but that didn't happen. So given the timeline that I've laid out from the GLMRS study in 2007 to now, any more delays in funding can really throw the project off. Right now, it's not slated to be complete until 2028, so we're already talking a really long timeline. We're also talking about carp moving very quickly towards the Great Lakes. So funding is super necessary. Congress must also authorize construction of structural protections at Brandon Road, so we're pushing that in the next version of the Water Resources Development Act, which is likely to be introduced in 2020. And given the fact that, going back to that basin slide and how many states touch the Great Lakes and the impact that this would have on the economy and the ecology of the Great Lakes, that the cost share for this, for construction of the Brandon Road protections, be adjusted to 100% full federal funding. Otherwise, the state of Illinois and others will have to come up with 35% of the funding for construction. I also want to flag that Congressman Huizinga's office is circulating a letter for sign-on that I will hand out if folks are interested, advocating for PED funding as well as that cost share adjustment. So find me if you want to check out that letter. And then there's a role for the states to play. So the state of Illinois obviously has the lion's share of responsibility here because the point of entry for Asian carp into the Great Lakes is Lake Michigan, which is in the state of Illinois. Previously, Governor Rauner, the state of Illinois, opposed Brandon Road and took pretty much every opportunity to downplay the threat of Asian carp to the Great Lakes and the risk of carp getting into the lakes. Since then, we've really experienced a sea change in perspective. So under Governor Pritzker, the stance has changed. Illinois has recognized the threat and risk and supported action at Brandon Road, which is all we could ever ask for. So we're really appreciative of that. And as the non-federal sponsor, the state has expressed some concerns about the cost of the project, again, because it's ballooned so much. So they are looking to partner with other states. So the most important next step for the state of Illinois is that they need to submit what's called a letter of intent to the Army Corps this spring so that the Corps can release the chief's report with a recommendation to Congress. Without the letter of intent saying that they are willing to be the local non-federal sponsor of the project, the Corps will end up releasing that chief's report without a recommendation, which pretty much will make it close to impossible to get construction done if Illinois doesn't sign on to the project. So we're working with the state of Illinois to get that done. It also, in the meantime, needs to come up with $2 million for the first year of pre-construction engineering and design. And the state of Michigan has actually has funding in its FY19 supplementation budget that could support this project. So there's an opportunity for states to work together on this. Illinois doesn't have to take on the entire responsibility. Other states are super interested in keeping Asian carp out of the Great Lakes. We know that Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, and New York have all submitted comments on the project that were so supportive. We also know that several states support moving toward that hydrologic separation that I talked about before. So beyond Brandon Road, we are advocating that the Corps continue under its GLMRS authorization to continue to look at two-way transfer of invasive species, but that not stop movement at Brandon Road and that the project continues simultaneously with looking at alternatives to protect the Mississippi River Basin from invasives from the Great Lakes. I think that's all that I wanted to cover today. This is my contact information. You can come find me after we're done. I also put Molly Flanagan's contact. Some of you may have worked with her. She's here quite often. And she does a lot of work on Asian carp and knows a lot more than me. So go ahead and reach out to either of us if you have questions. Thank you.
Aaron mentioned that ACRCC will be trying to do a congressional briefing probably either April or early May. I'm working with Bill at USEPA, who is the co-chair of ACRCC, to try to set up a time for all those folks to come and brief you guys on Brandon Road and the action plan, and I think they even want to talk about grass carp. So I'm going to move right forward in the interest of time to jump into our next segment on HABs. I'm very happy to have Gail Hess, I'm sorry. So many names. She's with the National Wildlife Federation, but previously served with Ohio EPA and has been very active on the habitat issues in Western Lake Erie, so I think she'll be very informative.
Thanks, Matt. I'm going to mix it up a little bit and talk from up here if my colleagues don't mind my back to you. And if it's possible, we'll just put the laptop down on the table. That would work. So as Matt said, I retired from a 32-year career with the state of Ohio, both with Ohio EPA when I was with Chris Perleski, was his director, and then I retired as executive director of the Ohio Lake Erie Commission before I came to NWR about 2 years ago. Does that mean I have to go vote? Is that what that buzzer is? No? Okay. All right, so I've been asked to talk about Lake Erie and the harmful algal blooms, but I guess as I will be talking about Lake Erie, it's also important to recognize that haves are not just a Lake Erie problem and they're not just a Great Lakes problem. We see occurrences of harmful algal blooms in our inland waters and that are creating significant problems, not just from a recreational standpoint, but from a drinking water standpoint as well. And so it's, here we go. So it's always good to get spatially oriented when we talk about Lake Erie. And why this is important in the context of this discussion is that Lake Erie is the southernmost, the shallowest, and also the warmest of all of the Great Lakes, which is part of the geography that contributes to its susceptibility to haves. And then when we look at Lake Erie, we talk about it in terms of three basins, the western basin, that central, and then eastern, where the large have blooms we are seeing, those are all in the western basin. We are seeing smaller scale blooms in some of the nearshore areas in other parts of Lake Erie, as well as other parts of the Great Lakes, but the large blooms that we're hearing about with the Toledo water crisis, that's all about the western basin. And you can see the shallowness of the western basin on that bottom graphic. And what this helps to illustrate and why this is just a creature of geography, but that big orange blob right there is the Maumee River Basin. So it's an immensely large land area that's draining to that western basin that's shallow and warm. And the predominant land use in the Maumee River Basin is agriculture. It's close to 90% in 4.5 million acres. So we know that it's, so there's a lot that tells us about why we're seeing those harmful algal blooms in the western basin of Lake Erie. And this is the big bloom that often gets referred to in 2011. It was an immensely large algal biomass, and that also moved eastward toward past Cleveland when all that biomass moved from the western basin into the central basin. I'm going to skip through here, and that was an aerial photo that made the National Geographic photo of the day from that particular bloom. But then I also wanted to talk about 2011. There's not a pointer on this thing, is there?
For chance.
This is a product of NOAA in conjunction with several other universities that combined their collective modeling efforts to develop a forecast annually based on what they project seasonal severity to be for that given year. But a couple of things about this. We just looked at photos from 2011, so that wasn't even the worst of the blooms that we have seen. It was over in 2015 where it bumped up even higher. And interestingly enough, that it was in the year 2014, I wish I had a pointer, but kind of like in between those two bars, if you can see where 2014 is, that was the year of the Toledo water crisis. So it wasn't necessarily the worst bloom that we've seen, or either of the among the three or four highest. But part of what created the Toledo water crisis was that it was a big bloom, but we also had a lot of wind out of the north that pushed all that biomass along that southern shore, and then created that algal biomass through the water column and in the path of the water intake in the city of Toledo. There were also some technology-related issues with the Toledo water treatment plant, that they have since upgraded and made some significant investments in, but it was a combination of factors that led to that particular crisis. It wasn't the only time we've had a water, drinking water-related issue related to a western basin harmful algal bloom. In 2013, Carroll Township in Ohio had to shut off a water supply based on algal toxins in the water supply, but they were able to pull in water from a different source. But anyhow, this is just to show you that NOAA, again, in conjunction with these other partners, developed this annual forecast, and that's what it looks like in that box and whisker over on the far right in red. They look at the minimum, the max, and the likely. So for the first time, the algal forecast was a little bit off this year. And so you can see we actually didn't reach that box and whiskers plot for 2018. But that was primarily because one of the models that was used for the forecast doesn't do well when it's a smaller bloom. They all perform pretty consistently when it's going to be a big bloom, but when there's a smaller bloom, so I think NOAA's going to drop that particular model in coming years. But it's an invaluable tool that comes out every year. And then in addition to that, NOAA puts out a bulletin twice weekly during the season. And because the bloom moves around a lot, it doesn't stay in one place based on wind and water patterns and conditions. The bloom will move around, so it becomes an invaluable tool for people that want to go recreate on the lake. It becomes important for water treatment plant operators that need to know what might be coming their way or what might be in their pathway. And so these are important informational tools used by both the public as well as public agencies. This is a slide just to show people, it's in response to one of those but what about questions, because people often ask about, is it coming from Detroit? Or the Detroit River coming there and that load from the upper Great Lakes. This is that just helps to illustrate the point that while there is loading coming down from the Detroit River, there's so much water associated with it, there's so much volume and flow that it serves to dilute it more than contribute to it. With all the loads that we know that we need high nutrient loads, we know that we need warm temperatures and still conditions. And there's just too much water coming down from the Detroit for that to actually be a feeder of the bloom. And then this is another example. There's, the image from 2011, but in contrast to 2012, which was a year of drought. And in that year, we saw just a fraction of a bloom. And that tells us a couple of things. One is that we're not seeing, and this has since been demonstrated with some research from the University of Toledo, that there's not much of the loading that's coming from the bottom sediments up in the Western Basin. And now we know, based on Dr. Bridgman's work, that's roughly 4 to 7% of the load comes from those bottom sediments. That could change, however, if there are sustained higher temperatures above a certain threshold for a period of time, then we are likely to see a much greater release from those bottom sediments. The other thing that this tells us is that as soon as we can turn down the tap of that loading coming from the Maumee River Basin, we won't get a bloom, that the lake will respond. And so it's just a matter of figuring out how do we stop that external loading coming into the Western Basin. So a number of different analyses have been done about where is it coming from, where are the nutrients coming from. And what we do know is that the majority of the load is delivered in the spring. We define spring as from the beginning of March to the end of June. And this is based on work that NOAA has done with Heidelberg and Ohio EPA and Ohio State. And so it's that period that defines what that annual forecast is going to look like. So right now, here we are at the end of March. Heidelberg and NOAA are starting to track what's coming into what's that delivery starting to look at. And we do know that it's not about the point sources or the wastewater treatment plants. Those were largely the issue back in the 70s and early 80s, when there was a lot of phosphorus coming from our wastewater treatment plants, but thanks to the Clean Water Act and some diligent implementation efforts to address that source of phosphorus, that's a nominal source. And certain models have shown that we could turn off all of the wastewater treatment plants and it won't move the needle at all on the Western Basin algal blooms. And plus, we also know that they've remained relatively constant over the years, so there's nothing that's changed with that delivery. We do know that, as I mentioned before, agriculture is the prevailing source. It represents close to 90% of the land use in the Wyoming River Basin. That percentage would change in different watersheds, in terms of how much of it is coming from agriculture versus other sources. We have done some analysis in Ohio with regards to septic tanks and home sewage treatment systems, and that represents a very low percentage in Ohio. Again, that could look different in a different in another watershed. And it's easy for a lot of people to conclude that it's all about over-application, that farmers are putting too much on. But what we know from work of NRCS, as well as some really important work on with some edge-of-field work in Ohio, is that it's less about how much is going on than how it's going on and when it's going on. We do know that when fertilizer is put on a field, that if it's put on in a broadcast method where it's just sprayed over the field, it's much more susceptible to runoff. But when we can incorporate it in with the soil profile, it binds up that phosphorus, locks it up, and makes it much less susceptible to a rainfall event and hence some runoff. And timing and, not applying on frozen or snow-covered or saturated ground, we've got some laws actually in Ohio to talk about that. We also know that the runoff that we are seeing is exacerbated by the increase in frequency and density of our rainfall events. And those patterns are clearly defined over the last 10 plus years, that more frequent intense storms, especially in the spring, when that delivery becomes critical for what's going to be a driver for the algal blooms. And Chris has mentioned, and has several others, the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement, and in there is Annex 4. And in Annex 4, which is about addressing nutrients in the Great Lakes, and what it says is to come up with some loading targets, and that Lake Erie shall be first. And so while I chaired a Lake Erie Phosphorus Task Force in Ohio, we initially came up with a 40% reduction of phosphorus as the defined need. I then served on the work group that developed the loading targets for Lake Erie. And we took a much more analytical, robust approach, looking at a multi-modeling approach, looking at a much detailed analysis. And while there's lots of ways to unpack the target, it basically equates to a 40% reduction. Whether we're talking about a 40% reduction for that spring load or whether we're talking about a 40% reduction for the annual load, that becomes the key of where we need to get to. This is a white paper that I was a co-author on that has since been published, and I've got a few copies, since been published in the Journal of Great Lakes Research, where we tried to pull a group of scientists together to say, what do we know and what don't we know? And there's some very disturbing things that we are learning about what we know. And a couple of things is that recently, Ohio EPA has been able to affirm that we are not seeing any, with all of the investments that have been made in the Western Basin of Lake Erie, but the Maumee River Basin in particular, we are not moving the needle on seeing any reductions in the concentration of the phosphorus being loading into the Western Basin. Very disturbing that we're not seeing anything, we're not seeing any movement towards that reduction yet. In addition, one of the scientists on this paper is a behavioral scientist, Dr. Robin Wilson, and she's been doing some annual surveys with farmers in the Maumee Basin. And now that she's got several years' worth, we can start to look at some trend information. And what she is finding is that we can look at certain adoption rates of the key practices for what we're recommending, for what needs to happen to hold back that phosphorus. There's a certain amount of a certain adoption rate for those practices each year, which is great. However, it's mirrored by a similar percentage of farmers dropping those practices. So essentially, we're not seeing any net increase in the adoption of the practices that we need to see. So clearly, we need to be rethinking our approach and how we look at this in terms of our policies and programs for delivery. So what do we need? So when we talk about agricultural practices, the ones that we know have that have risen to the top in terms of effectiveness, and we know this from the edge of field research that's happening in Ohio and that NRCS has been a critical partner in, is that subsurface placement, getting that fertilizer in contact with the soil. We do know that it's soil test-informed application rates. One of the things that has become critical to understand with this issue is that any given field, it's not the same soil test level across the field. We are seeing individual pockets of high soil test levels of phosphorus that might just be within one corner of a field or a portion of a field, and so it becomes really important to know what that variability is. And some of that has to do with what we refer to as legacy phosphorus from some past practices where phosphorus has built up in the soil profile and will take a long time to leach out. But it's just that understanding that any given field is just not the same across that field. In addition to the fact that any given farmer or any individual farm operation is going to be unique in its own way due to different decisions that are made based on crop rotation patterns, based on different management practices, so that the answer needs to be individually prescriptive, that it's connected to the individual farm operations and to work with that farm operation to get to that. And we can't lose sight of the erosion control and the water management, because we also have, in addition to a nutrient problem, we have a water management problem. Because of those intense, frequent rainstorms, we need to be employing those practices that help to hold the water back. Because if we can hold that water back in the spring, then we have less of that runoff happening and that delivery into the Maumee River and into the Western Basin. And so we need to be looking at how do we remove those barriers for practice adoption, real and perceived. And again, in the paper, you'll see that Dr. Wilson talks about those real barriers in terms of cost and logistics, getting the equipment needed to do subsurface placement is a heavy lift, and it's not ubiquitous across the landscape. And it means the farmer has to substantially change how he operates his farm to incorporate that practice. But then there's also some perceived barriers in terms of how farmers perceive their own efficacy in the ability to utilize and adopt a practice that they, in terms of whether they think they can do it effectively and whether or not it's really going to work. And so those are some perception issues that we've got to work around. Then we also can't take our eye off of research and monitoring. An enormous investment has been made in Ohio with regards to what do we know about harmful algal blooms, both in terms of farm operations and what's coming off the field, in addition to what's happening with our public water systems and the treatment technologies needed to deal with algal toxins coming through our water supplies. But there's still a lot that we need to know, and we can't take our eye off the ball. And then going forward, it's also about the buzzword of the day now is about accountability, and we need a different kind of framework for accountability. Because I mentioned that we're not seeing the needle move in terms of nutrient reduction. We're not seeing the needle move in terms of practice adoption. So we need, if we're going to be making public investments, which we need to, but we also need to be able to tie it to water quality outcomes. And we need to be able to extract trend information on a watershed basis. So with regards to practice adoption and what's happening in any given watershed, to what's happening at a water quality output point, and so that we can be able to link those metrics with what's happening on the land to what's happening on the water. And then real quickly, I'll just end with this as we wrap up. What we do, for me, the signpost is that we know that after the wastewater treatment plants controlled their phosphorus, Lake Erie had a rebound. And if there was a big resurgence after the fire on the Cuyahoga River and all of the bad issues with Lake Erie, that in copies of the Lorax, Dr. Sue said, I hear things are just as bad up in Lake Erie. Well, when Lake Erie recovered in the late 80s and early 90s, there were a group of educators and school children that wrote to Dr. Seuss and said, hey, wait, the lake is cleaned up. Our lake isn't, you shouldn't be besmirching our Great Lake. And so, to his credit, Dr. Seuss responded. And he said, I do agree with you that the condition of Lake Erie needs a bit of revision. And what I love about this is that I should no longer be saying bad things about a body of water that recognizing that its great civic and scientific effort is now the home of my own research. So my hope is that we can get there, been there once, and then the system will respond. And it's also to note that if you have a copy of the Lorax on your bookshelf at home, you should check the date, because all of the editions after 1992, he took that line out. And so the ones with that line in it are now worth quite a bit of money on eBay. And so with that, it's all about putting our best foot forward. And I'll leave these copies up here.
Now we're going to have a... Edwin Martinez is with the NRCS. He's actually the GLRI coordinator here in D.C., so he'll be able to talk about some of the federal response.
All right. I'll begin that presentation going. I have a few parts. I know we're running out of time, so I want to make sure that if you have any questions, you can email me or something. I'm Dr. Edwin Martinez. I am original from Puerto Rico. I work for the Natural Resources Conservation Service here in Washington, D.C. I'm a current natural resource specialist, work in multiple areas within the states, and actually spent 8 years within the Great Lakes region, so it's one of the best times in my career back in Michigan. The Natural Resource Conservation Service Agency, just to give you the briefing of this, basically the agency is the primary or principal agency within the USEA that deliver conservation. There was a lot of information regarding conservation application, conservation practices, et cetera, that Gail mentioned. Everybody set the road for me in terms of what they spoke about. They talk about some of the issues, invasive species, water quality, GLRI in general, the action plan, et cetera. And you will see that in my presentation, so I'm going to be really brief on those areas. But we do follow what is the 9 steps of conservation planning, basically working with the landowner, identify what the problem or the opportunities are on that specific farm, and moving forward from there all the way to implementing conservation and then doing evaluation. Those are just a simple explanation of the 9 steps of conservation planning. It's more complex. You're addressing every single resource concern, water quality, air, plants, animals, etc. Energy. All of those are being looked. Gail mentioned about the harmful algae blooms. That is not only a Great Lakes issue, even though we all hear about Western Lake Erie Basin and that area because it's a really hot spot. But also they're all over the nation. The green spots are basically where algae bloom has been detected. The yellow or orange spots are actually where they have some pictures or information on those. NRCS does target conservation. So I mentioned that we do conservation, basically working with private landowners, tribes, conservation districts, and many other partners. Many of them are seated here on the table, but we work with hand-in-hand on a daily basis. So we deliver conservation under Farm Bill authorities. One that is really known and common is the Environmental Quality Incentive Program, EQIP. Many of you, if you have worked with your local conservation districts or if you have worked with other local units of government, you may have heard about this program. This is the big program that the agency has that addresses every single resource concern. We have also another one that is not listed in here that is CSP that basically targets conservation but actually reward landowners who are doing good conservation practices. There's many of these individual efforts, and I'm going to have a slide for each of them. But the one that I'm going to emphasize the most is GLRI because it's the one that I actually manage here as part of my agency. So the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, Chris did an outstanding job explaining the initiative, etc. Basically, a lot of the words that were said earlier, you know, catalyst, collaboration, amplification of conservation, that's what we're doing. We have our Farm Bill conservation programs, and GLRI allows the agency to deliver conservation and target conservation in a specific locations that perhaps we as an agency with the funding that we have that might be limited, we won't be able to get. We were talking about target conservation, Great Lakes Basin again. These are the priority watersheds within GLRI. And within GLRI, there's also phosphorus priority watersheds. Those are watersheds that are targeting phosphorus reduction, including the Western Lake Erie Basin. Phosphorus reduction to allow to avoid the algae bloom in the Great Lakes region, for example. Great Lakes Action Plan, the only thing I'm going to say about the Great Lakes Action Plan is that NRCS, under all the different focus areas that the Great Lakes Action Plan has, NRCS does work on invasive species, non-point source, and wildlife habitat. The one that we're going to be talking today is non-point source, water quality. Top conservation practices on GLRI. This is just to give you a perspective. Gail mentioned some of them. One that is really critical is nutrient management. That's basically understanding the specific land unit, how the nutrients or how the soil is behaving in that land unit to make application of nutrients effectively in a way that the landowner is having an economical benefit and also an environmental impact. Many of them, here you have millions of dollars that we have spent on those practices. On the other side, we have how many practices per contract. When you look at and try to come up with a correlation or relation on this graph, you may say, well, but wastewater facilities, there's only a few of them, and the cost is really expensive. It's because a wastewater facility can cost over or close to $500,000, depending on the size. So that's the main reason. But all of these conservation practices are the ones that we found that are the top 10 for GLRI under NRCS. Cover crop, you may have heard about it, wastewater facility, nutrient management, agrochemical handling facilities, heavy use, etc. Somebody else had a slide on partnership. This one does not contain all the partners that we have as an agency, but what I wanted to highlight is in here is how NRCS works with USGS to get the water information, water flow, et cetera, with NOAA for weather, with EPA for water quality, with Forest Service for when we're addressing forest land, Fish and Wildlife Service for wildlife habitat improvement, APHIS for control of invasive species, Army Corps for other practices. So you see that connection. It goes down to also other entities of government, including tribes that we work directly on a daily basis. So the partnership is really extensive. This is just some examples. We're talking about Asian carp. There's a project in Indiana that is Eagle March, and it was a collaboration between NRCS and the Army Corps to control Asian carp. Some conservation efforts. Demonstration farms. Basically here, farmers are educating other farmers, just to make a really short summary on this. This is agreements that the states will have utilizing GRI funding and showcasing how conservation practices are working on their farm. This is another agreement using GRI funding. This is in Michigan, and it's basically to reduce phosphorus coming or entering into this Saginaw Bay watershed. And this is working with the conservation district, as you can see. Others. Agreements that we have at the national level is with the Great Lakes Commission, that we have some of our team members in here. And this one is primarily focusing on reducing sediments and nutrients at the watershed basin level. Edge of the field monitoring was actually mentioned earlier. This is basically the science behind the technology and the conservation practices application that we're doing. So we're looking at different phases. We're looking at how we're installing conservation practices in a specific location. We do traditional farming in another one, and then we evaluate water quality and soil health in those conditions and to see how conservation practices improved those conditions, reduce sediments, reduce nutrients, etc. This is a project that we have in Wisconsin that is the connection between edge of the field monitoring that based on water quality and soil health. Soil health basically doing the evaluation, you do conservation on the ground, how that conservation is actually improving soil health that eventually is going to improve farm operations. More infiltration, more retention of nutrients, you name it. Other conservation efforts, and this goes back to that list that I have earlier. This is the Western Lake Erie Basin. This is an initiative that NRCS started in 2016 and is targeting the Western Lake Erie Basin for additional funding on conservation. So the Western Lake Erie Basin has regular NRCS funds, GLRI funds, and Western Lake Erie Basin in addition to other ones to control, to work on conservation. What I like really much about this slide is that it has the connection, avoiding, controlling, trapping, and managing. That's really big in the Western Lake Erie Basin because that's what takes us to the algae bloom. The National Water Quality Initiative, again, it actually has some projects within the Great Lakes Basin, and this is targeting conservation on a specific waters that are impaired to try to delist them, to try to improve the water quality in those areas. Another one is the Regional Conservation Partnership, RCPP, that is really big and has been ongoing for a couple of years. It has critical conservation areas, including the Great Lakes Basin region. So this basically allows another method for us to do work with partners and also increase our investment, because we have there is a lot of opportunity for more research and more conservation implementation. CIG, this is another one that you will hear frequently, conservation innovation grants. There's many of them, including some of them within the Great Lakes Basin. The one that I'm just going to mention here is the hydrogeologic monitoring to support NRCS practice evaluation, basically doing some type of research to see if our practice are really effective on the field. NRCS financial assistance just goes back to the Western Lake Erie, just to give you an idea. As I mentioned earlier, you have how much money per fiscal year and all the initiatives that are different colors. So we have the Western Lake Erie Initiative, RCPP, and GLRI, and other programs, all targeting that specific location, just because of the importance. To make the connection between our agency, science and technology is really big. It's something that we do. There's something that is called conservation effects assessment projects. These basically does evaluation of NRCS programs at the big scale. Practices that were installed in the past versus practices that are currently installed, see how that behaves and see how actually that improves water quality, soil health, you name it. Some example of conservation practices, just a few pictures. You may have seen some of this in different locations. Stream crossing for, could be salmon, could be written, you know, in could be fish, etc. Grass waterway with an outlet, a wastewater facility that is under construction, and another stream crossing. Basically, some of the practices will benefit a specific water quality, but others will have an effect on water quality and also wildlife habitat and other resource concerns. Multiple pictures in here, waterway, sacking facility, another wastewater facility, animal mortality, and some other underground conservation practices. And this is kind of the ones that we do. What we do here, basically, we do the design all the way to installation, inspection. We provide financial and technical assistance working with the landowners. This is a good example. We mentioned about erosion. This is a waterway that I designed when I used to work in Michigan in Clinton County. The waterway conditions were when we met with the landowner, then when we designed and installed the waterway, and then like a year and a half later, this is how it looks like. You can see the difference from where it started all the way to where it is right now. It's really impressive. With that, if there's any questions, please let me know. Otherwise, send me an email and I will get back to you as soon as I can. And I appreciate the opportunity.
So we are almost out of time, but I wanted to have Victoria come back up and talk about some of the initiatives the Great Lakes Commission has been working on, especially with green infrastructure. And is there a continuation of your slide?
Yeah.
Okay.
Either your boss was told you had to stay here to the bitter end, or you're all waiting to hear about resiliency and infrastructure. And I apologize to my colleague Sri, who is going to precede me. I know you're going to do another briefing, but hopefully we can talk some more about this. So the title of this session was going to be resiliency, and I put green in parentheses because it's not just about green, it's about gray. I'm going to talk a little bit about our work there, too. Really quickly, I think there's actually a handout, which wasn't mine, in your packet that talks about climate trends. I'm not going to, you can look at that. Climate trends are happening. We're experiencing climate change, and it's affecting our water infrastructure. So how does climate relate to water infrastructure? We have urban stresses. We have runoff. Then you can have surges that come from the lakes and aging infrastructure in urban areas. You can think of ag and like our rural areas as kind of our rural water infrastructure. And there's really the green infrastructure and the hard stuff, the gray, the pumps and the pipes, are more in our towns and our cities. So what we're observing, and you can read a lot in the literature about this, it's called this cascading impacts. You have a change in precipitation, then you have
then it leads to other environmental impacts that normally we would have when there are disturbances, but the disturbances go faster, they're stronger, and they're having a greater degradation on our environment, as you can see in this picture of coastal erosion in Lake Ontario. We also have increased pollutant loads. You can have haves as one of the contributing outcomes from that. Stormwater overflows, urban stormwater as well. All of this increases stress and pressure because you have more need for greater infrastructure. The infrastructure we have today was most of it in the eastern part of our country was built over 50 years ago, a lot of it over 100 years ago, and it wasn't meant to deal with the volumes that are coming in now. In 2017, the Great Lakes Commission produced a joint action plan for clean water infrastructure and services. There's an executive summary in your packet, and there are a few full copies of the report on the table out there. It's only about 20 pages. And on the right-hand side, basically what we did is we looked at needs versus the investment gap over a 20-year period. And we did it on the U.S. and the Canadian side. I just pulled the $9.6 billion number annually out here, which is just the U.S. side of that. So it's big, and it's growing every year. And with each year you defer, it's like when you defer maintenance on your car, your house, it gets more and more expensive to catch up to being in that quality place that you want to be. Green infrastructure, it's simply just a part of the infrastructure, the entire infrastructure space. So we have stormwater, of which green infrastructure can be a part, as well as drinking water and wastewater. In 2018, I did a briefing here with the Northeast, with thanks to the Northeast Midwest Institute, and we talked about this report where we looked specifically at policy barriers at the federal, state, and provincial level to implementing green infrastructure. We know that largely this occurs at the local levels. It's the cities and the towns that are doing this stuff on the day-to-day basis. But how do programs like the SRF fund, you know, how does that either provide a barrier or an incentive for the cities and communities to do this work? So we have a series of recommendations in this report, and I don't have a ton of time to go over it, but I will point to one slide at the end. I want to talk about resiliency, too. Many of you have heard about the proposed Army Corps of Engineers Coastal Resiliency Study. We at the Great Lakes Commission submitted a letter in support of that. There's no funding as of yet that we for that. And in the meantime, we've heard about the Glimmer study, same thing. The Corps can do good studies, but it often takes a lot of money and a lot of time. And in the meantime, we're watching our communities continue to face, you know, pounding storms, coastal erosion, degradation, sewage overflows, loss of property, loss of economic activity. And so we are in the early stages of talking about doing something that we lead at the Great Lakes Commission to sort of get a better understanding of what is being done in the region with respect to coastal resiliency, what programs, what activities. And then this could inform the core study. Again, you won't find anything on our website. It's more internal conversation, but if you want more information or keep following up with us, and we can update you as our thinking evolves in this space. Green infrastructure, you should think about it as part of the type of the tool in the toolbox when it comes to all sorts of infrastructure, from structural to institutional. And then finally, this is a snapshot on the left-hand side of the screen of this report, the cover of the report. We had a series of recommendations in there, recognizing that infrastructure is the responsibility of federal, state, provincial, and local governments. We bucketed our recommendations accordingly. There were 7 federal recommendations. I summarized them here, the top 3. But again, in the interest of time, I know you guys have been so patient. I just encourage you to look at the full report. Again, we have executive summaries in your packet here. Some of these were addressed in the WERDA 2018, and we're really appreciative of that, but not all of them. And so we will be coming back and talking to your bosses about picking up where some of those that were left on the table for the next go around. And that's all I've got.
Trying to make up some time.
So that will actually conclude the program unless anybody has questions or anybody wants to add anything. I know it's been a lot of information to digest, but feel free to
contact me with any questions. I'll send follow-up materials and information about our upcoming briefings, including one on water policy and water law that Shree will be working on, and the Asian carp stuff that we're working to put together. So I will be in touch. So thank you very much for coming.
Comment from me. Dave pointed out at the very beginning, I think it's just what you use 3 hours. I mean, think the volume of issues and material that all these people are trying to deal with and trying to keep it straight. So I think Dave's point about the need for communication, again, a czar won't work. No one can manage all this by themselves. Issue a fiat that this is how it should be done. And that's part of the problem. It's such a large. First is the large ecological area, but the size, the complexity, and the number of problems we're dealing with are almost overwhelming.
Matt, if I could add, I'm going to give you 2 minutes, and I think this is all you need to know. You didn't have to sit here all day, but maybe I'll. The 70s, we tried to stop the bleeding. You know, everything was just getting dumped into the Great Lakes and everything. And the legal structure, Clean Water Act, really made huge progress during the 70s. And Lake Erie and Cuyahoga River were big instigators for all of that. The 80s is when we started to undo the damage from the past. And you didn't hear much about Superfund today, and it's very unpopular in general. But a huge amount was accomplished to the benefit of the Great Lakes starting in the 80s. The 90s, and I remember particularly Senator Voinovich, who said we were a wonderful orchestra but had no conductor, and Congressman Dingell, who said, you're speaking with all sorts of different voices. You've got to get your voices together. So in the 90s, we started to get in the process, and with remedial action plans that Matt talked about, and lakewide management plans, kind of some planning. The 2000s, things started to galvanize, and there was something very important called Everglades Envy. The Everglades got $8 billion in 2000, happened to coincide with the presidential election. I'm sure it had nothing to do with it, but so if the Everglades can get $8 billion, why can't the Great Lakes get something? That's when things started to galvanize, healing our waters, and then the executive order really started to pull people together. And one person in particular, a philanthropist in Grand Rapids, Peter Wege, wrote out a check for, I think, $7 million to get Healing Our Waters together. So that's when people really started to coordinate and collaborate. That is now paying dividends, so that since 2010, we were able to hit the ground running because of the work that had been done between 2000 and 2010. I think, and then with the 2 Great Lakes Action Plans, Restoration Action Plans, and now working on the 3rd, we're really poised, and that's all 50 years that I just described in a couple minutes, more than 2. But I think we're really ready to kind of launch into another era, if you will, and making use of that GLRI money. And it's important to recognize that there is other money that is out there as well. There's conservation funding out of Department of Agriculture. I think, is the Legacy Act incorporated into GLRI? So that's there. There's still a lot of Superfund activity, both private and public money there. And then there are other little pockets everywhere. So continuing to kind of integrate these investment programs to get maximum return on them. And the infrastructure is there organizationally, legally, and whatever. So I think we're poised for a decade of tremendous success. So have a great weekend. You are a great audience.